Hello again, friends. And you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast. The only podcast on Turner Time. The Mothership! The best wrestling podcast on the planet. The only wrestling podcast that matters. Call somebody. I am your host, the great Brian Last.
It's me!
And I think for some reason I'm screaming this week. I just realized.
Yeah! Baby, baby.
And I'm very happy to welcome back to the co-host chair, John McAdam. It's been a while since you've been on, John, but we always have a good time. Welcome back to the Super Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's always a great time, and it's a little bit intimidating. I am in the chair that Jim Cornette was in last week, so some pretty high company for once in my life.
Well, yeah, I guess you could look at it that way. It's this chair gets passed around a lot. It's
the Sue the Shooter of chairs.
The Sue the Shooter of chairs, the co-host chair on the Super Podcast. But hey, like I said, it's great to have you back on the show. And wanted to talk to you about a bunch of things this week. I want to remind everyone there will be no top 10 this week. The top 10 will return either next episode or the episode after that. And this is what it's going to be going forward. The top 10 won't necessarily be every episode. It will be at least every two or three episodes probably in between. But John, as we begin talking here, and we have a lot of really cool things in store for everyone today on the show, I wanted to talk to you about the 30 for 30 with Ric Flair. The only time it was brought up on the show was when my father brought it up to say how the women he hangs out with can kick the crap out of Charlotte Flair or whatever else he said. But I know that you, have always been a huge Ric Flair fan. So I'm curious your thoughts on the special.
Well, one weird thing about me, I was a huge Ric Flair fan before I ever saw him on television. I saw him in magazines and I was like, oh my God, look at this guy. He's so great. And then I remember the first time I ever saw him on television, October 3rd, 1981, when I was surprised when he walked out with the NWA belt. But I thought it was a fantastic 30 for 30. I am a huge fan of that series. And the way that series works, almost the less I know about a subject coming in, the more I enjoy the episode. Like the Matt Hoffman episode, the guy who, you know, rides a bike and does crazy stunts on it. I knew nothing about it. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. Flair, I didn't really learn anything past the anecdotes, but I thought they did an excellent job. And I'm bearing in mind the target audience for that 30 for 30 is not you or I. It's not the people who listen to the 605. It is a more general audience, someone who knows Ric Flair in passing. I think they did a great job presenting Ric Flair and presenting his story to those people.
What did you think of the story? I mean, I think I heard from a few people, and not too many, I think, because it doesn't make sense, that said, oh, well, you know, it really paints him in this dark light. But I think that's realistic. That's kind of what he's been going through the last few years. But, you know, I guess when, you know, in 1989, when Flair turns 40, and, you know, they're already trying to retire him. They're already trying to get him to stay down. How did you think Ric Flair would be at this point in time? You know, everyone always said, what would he do? Would he be a manager because he can cut great promos? Would he be a commentator? What did you think back then? Where did you think Ric Flair would be in 2017?
Oh, man, I couldn't even imagine. I thought he'd be, you know, just basically a memory. I mean, back then, they didn't have, like, old-timer shows or Hall of Fames or, you know, anything like that. What was the show WCW had where they brought in the legends and they'd have them wrestle a match in black and white? So it's so ridiculous.
Slamboree.
Slamboree, thank you. Like, I figured he'd be just like, you know, like Lou Fez was in 1989 or Dick the Bruiser was in 1989, just a guy who, you know, maybe make an occasional appearance, but for the most part was unknown by the more recent modern fans.
Slamboree 93 is good for one reason. There is a match. I forget what the match is supposed to be. I think it's Don Morocco and someone versus Bob Armstrong and Thunderbolt Patterson. And Bob Armstrong can't wrestle, so Brad Armstrong is suddenly in the Legends match. And Thunderbolt gets on the mic before a match, and I don't know what he was trying to say, but he was just like, he just starts making noises, and I think it's Zbyszko on commentary. It's like, what did he say?
Thunderbolt was the greatest. That guy got me out of bed on a Saturday morning when I was like 19 years old because I wanted to see him so badly on that 1984 Georgia show. I'm not saying he was good. I'm saying you couldn't take your eyes off of him. I would like to. Ooh, that was his whole promo, and it was phenomenal.
Well, let's play one of his promos here. I just pulled it up. This is Thunderbolt Patterson in 1990. Remember, after Ole Anderson takes over the book, he gets it from the Ric Flair-led booking team that had Kevin Sullivan and Jim Cornette on it. Ole Anderson takes over. And right away, you start seeing all these weird changes that you wouldn't necessarily make if you were running a company in 1990, even before the Black Scorpion. JYD's brought back. I know Orndorff ended up wrestling a number of years after, but something about Orndorff in 1990 and WCW just didn't fit right. And Thunderbolt's back. And even though Thunderbolt always had problems with the office, him and Ole actually get along. Ole and Thunderbolt, I think a lot of people would be surprised by that. They're actually friends. Like, they get along. So Ole brings Thunderbolt back. And of course, eventually Thunderbolt has a problem with someone and he's gone, even though Ole's in charge. But Thunderbolt's there and he cuts this promo about what he's going to do at this upcoming show. Listen to this, John. You may have heard this before.
Championship Wrestling gave me the opportunity again to keep my eyeballs on the Ole. You have ruined folks' lives. Not talking about how you dealt with mine in the past, but in the recently, you have been getting on everybody's case. So this Sunday, if you move, I am going, if you move, this Sunday, it's time that, I'm so full, I'm full up to here. Same old. But they say it's going to be a change. There will be a change. History has already been made. Call somebody. Tell somebody, only if you move, just move.
Well, there it is. He didn't say anything. He literally didn't finish his sentence the whole promo.
Quick question, was he wearing his Janitors for Justice shirt that he wore on the Downey show?
No, you see, that's the thing. There are different looks to Thunderbolt. This is Thunderbolt when he kind of looks like a preacher because he's in a suit and he's not actually saying anything, but he's just so, you know, I can only describe it like he's like a preacher. He's like an evangelist. It's just he doesn't say anything. Just if you move, what will you do if he moves? He doesn't tell you. I'm full up to here. I think it was in Ole's book where he says, I asked him one day, I said, what are you full of? And he couldn't give me an answer.
Oh, man. I don't know if you know the backstory on this. Ole wanted the Thunderbolt to manage the Steiners, and Scott Steiner just wasn't having it, and he wasn't making Thunderbolt's life a very happy place, so Thunderbolt went home.
If I did know that, I don't remember that. That's interesting. What a weird pairing, too. Why would you, beyond the personality conflict that developed there, obviously, why would you put the Steiners with Thunderbolt?
Neither of those. Well, if you have to have a role for Thunderbolt, which clearly you do not, but if you did, it would be a mouthpiece, and neither of the Steiners were particularly good on interviews. So I kind of get that. I just don't, I could have told you it wouldn't have worked, though.
So it would have been a Steiners with Thunderbolt versus Doom with Teddy Long.
Oh, what could have been?
Hey, Doom were good. I actually was a fan of Doom. And I feel like a lot of people forget that Butch Reed had a career after the natural Butch Reed. You know, it's weird saying that because I know Doom, you know, were around and some people liked him. But like, it's like people forget Butch Reed was still around after that WWF run.
Yeah, Doom, when they first started, they were fairly terrible. I think neither guy was used to wearing a mask. And I think I've mentioned this before. I was there at the Philadelphia Civic Center when Doom debuted. And the little, like, 10-year-old kid in front of me starts screaming Butch Reed and Ron Simmons. So it was that much of a surprise. But I saw a match of theirs at where was it in Boston? At the wherever Boston University has their basketball games. And first thing, the BU football team tried to pick a fight with Doom. And I'm like, they would beat the shit out of all 40 of you. Do not mess with these guys. Number two, it was Doom against the Steiners. One of the best matches I've ever seen live. These guys beat the crap out of each other. It was so stiff.
I recently did something on the Mothership page where I wrote this. I just said, I feel the Steiners are really underrated because I never really hear them in the conversation for all-time great tag teams. And I feel like for a little while you did when they were active, but now you don't. And if you look at them from 89 to 94, a five-year period, they're phenomenal. I mean, you know, they're stiff as hell, but it's just they're unlike anything else. And, you know, I know WCW wasn't very good through those years, but when you look at it, it is interesting. It was built around the young guns were going to be the Steiners, Sting, Luger, and Pillman. And Sting's the only one that really hung out the whole time.
I think the Steiner's biggest problem, as you said, during that run, the WCW audience was diminishing, to say the least. So you have fewer eyeballs on them, and it's really looked at as a dark era in wrestling, that early 90s when, you know, I mean, both WCW and WWF are pretty hard to watch.
Yeah, I think WCW, for me, it's 91 that's really the true bottom, when it bottomed out. Because, like, even in 1990 when Ole was booking, there was still cool stuff. Like, I mean, that's when Steiner's and the Nasty Boys was happening. That's when Luger and Hansen. Like, there was good stuff. It's just there was really, really bad stuff you didn't want on NWA programming. By 91, that's, like, the height of everything people complain about with Jim Herd and Dusty booking. Oz, Big Josh with the Bears on the pay-per-view event. Just, it's, like, all the introduction of that stuff and then Flair leaving. And it's like 91 to me is where WCW bottoms out completely.
I am inclined to agree. Here's the thing. Like, you know, we were all big NWA fans. They were the opposite of WWF. The guys were cool. They came to have good matches. They had interesting programs. It wasn't aimed at little kids. And then they finally got Dusty out. And, I mean, you can only imagine it was like the revolution had been won. Dusty was gone. No more stupid Dusty stuff. And then when they brought him back, just 2 years later, I personally emotionally just gave up on the product. I mean, there was still hope before they rehired Dusty. Now it's like, man, this is over.
Speaking of Slamboree before, I remember when Dave Meltzer reviewed Slamboree 94 in The Observer. Dusty was one of the legends not there, even though he was under contract at WCW. He was working for WCW. I don't know if he was – he wasn't booking at that time. Flair would have been booking at that point in 94, but Dusty was still there in some role or another. And he wasn't there with the legends, but he sent in a promo. And in the promo, he's like, I'm not retired. I'm in my prime. And Dave Meltzer on The Observer, he's like, that was the scariest thing I've ever heard, you know, in wrestling. The fact that in 1994, he would say that he wasn't retired. And he did come back.
As soon as you said Dusty wasn't part of the show, I immediately I knew why. Because Dusty, you know, he at that point was not considering himself a retired legend. He thought he had another run in him.
You think he did if he had turned heel?
It depends on the level of the run. I mean, if they put Dusty in, I personally don't believe in turning a guy like Dusty heel. He's too much of an institution. You know, whether you like him or not, you don't turn guys like Bruno Sammartino or Dusty Rhodes. But if they had brought him in like a mid-card program, a tag team with Dustin or coming to Dustin's aid, yeah, I think it would have worked.
You could turn an institution if the basis for the institution is corrupt. Because then they can use that as, like, feeding their complaint, if that makes sense. Like, Brett. You know, Brett stayed the same. He was still true to Brett. It's just he thought that the system, you know, in kayfabe, obviously, the system was corrupt. Vince was corrupt. The way the WWF takes care of Shawn Michaels was corrupt. It's funny that all these things ended up being behind-the-scenes thoughts, too, but they started out just on TV. I think Dusty would have killed it as a heel. I think his promos would have been incredible. I think Dusty had an interesting relationship with a lot of the fans that sat at ringside, you know, as John Hitchcock has talked about, you know, from, what, 88 on. So I don't know. I think Dusty as a heel, it would have been interesting.
All right, a couple of things. I have seen Dusty as a heel, and I know this is going to sound very backwards, but when I saw it, I'm like, oh my God, this is like young Terry Gordy. That's exactly who he was. Right when things were falling apart for Dusty in the NWA, Jim Herd, from what I understood, was insistent that Dusty turn heel. And the plan was constantly changing at that point, but they were going to make Dusty the head horseman, and the four horsemen were going to be Dusty Rhodes, Butch Reed, Bob Orton Jr., and Barry Windham as like a cowboy outfit. This was on the table at one point.
Jeez. You know, so many things could have gone differently early 89. You know, Jim Herd obviously comes in, but this is right around the time where they're interviewing Bill Watts, they're interviewing Larry Matisick. This is when you also have Jim Barnett gets brought back into the mix. This is when you have George Scott comes in as the booker. Mulligan's in there for a little bit. Like, so many things could have gone different. Like, what if they had put Bill Watts in charge in 89? You know, just 2 years removed from UWF. How do you think that would have worked out?
Hard to say, because Watts was used to running his own company, doing whatever he wanted to do. You would have Gino Hernandez wrestling Mr. Wrestling 2, and Bill Watts spent the whole match bitching about the Fiesta Bowl. So I wonder how Watts would have done operating under any set of rules. But, I mean, you're right. He was only 2 years removed from UWF, and I mean, UWF in 1986 and 1987, when Watts still owned it, was phenomenal. So who knows? He might have turned the thing around. And he wasn't afraid to go head to head with Vince McMahon. He wasn't afraid to, you know, get into legal battles with him, to knock the WWF on television, which I think Crockett should have done. But it would have been way interesting. I think we've talked about this before. What if Bill Watts had been the guy who got WTBS in 1985? I think it would be a whole different world.
Yeah, that would have been the game changer, because he would have been, first of all, in partnership with Ted Turner. It wouldn't, mm-hmm. it wouldn't have been just you're on my network. It would have been you're going to be my partner and we're going to expand this operation. You know, there's so many things that we haven't even talked about with this. You know, would the TV show end up looking the way it did in 1986, or would it have stayed in the studio? You know, what would it have been? And again, would Watts and Turner have been able to get along in the long run?
Yeah, I mean, I think Watts definitely would have taken it out of the studio. I mean, he got out of the Irish McNeil Boys Club and started doing his TV tapings at big arenas. I don't think he would have had as direct a line to Turner. I think there would have been a go-between of some sort. But, you know, it had Watts, you know, and I think he's a guy, once again, he had the belly for a fight. He would have, you know, gone head-to-head with McMahon on pay-per-views. I could see Bill Watts coming out with an idea like, oh, WrestleMania 3's on, let's run a free show, that sort of thing.
Well, you know, out of all the territorial promoters at that time, he was the most competitive. He was the one who was most into competing, you know, not just in sports, but in business. And he was also the most business-minded.
Yeah.
Out of all those guys, out of Vern and Crockett, Eddie Graham's out of the picture by this point, but really it's Vern, Crockett, Fritz, Watts. I mean, those are really the big four at this point. Watts is the one I would put all my chips behind.
Oh, same here. And talk about competitive. I mean, we're talking 1982, before there's even a war, before there's even a battle. He's on Mid-South Wrestling saying, you know, oh, well, Paul Orndorff's a big wheel on WTBS. He's the Georgia heavyweight champion. And Bob Roop ran him out of here. So how good must the wrestling be on WTBS?
Yeah, he was the master of that. I remember when right around the time Hogan beat the Iron Sheik, that was showed every week on TV. That was the intro to championship wrestling for, you know, every week for a couple of years. Watts had, like, I think it was maybe, I was going to say Butch Reed, but maybe it wasn't Butch Reed, but he had someone on there just destroying the Iron Sheik in Houston. And he would pretend like it was a current match. Like, here's the Iron Sheik. You may see him on that other TV show. Well, here he is. You see, he can't cut it. You know, it's the same variation of that every time.
Oh, when Bundy was getting his big push in the WWF, he had a match where Bundy did a job for Dr. Death, and he called Bundy an overweight pachyderm.
that's a funny one. And then, I mean, like, even when he would show those montages of guys really getting hurt, and he would be like, I mean, it's funny now with concussions and everything, him bragging about it. He's like, you see these chair shots Bobby Fulton's taking? It's not like Titan Sports, where they use a gimmick chair where it breaks as soon as you hit someone with it. And it's just, it's like, wow, he's breaking kayfabe for them.
Oh, he loved that chair thing. Jim Ross was on one of the shows saying, and it looked like that chair may have been tampered with before.
That video was great, though. It really was. It was like Jake DDTing Terry Taylor on the chair. It was Dr. Death slugging Terry Taylor in the head with the football helmet. It was the Bobby Fulton chair shots. It was a few other things, too. There was some great stuff in that.
They had Butch Reed with his eye swollen shut talking about how it happened during a match, and it actually happened during a dressing room brawl with John Nord.
That's right. That's right. You know what? Unpopular opinion. It's not necessarily slaughtering a sacred cow, just an unpopular opinion. John Nord was good in Mid-South with Jake. I'm not saying he was a great worker or anything, but I'm saying that was the best usage of John Nord ever. Having him as this barbarian, he wasn't Nord the Barbarian, he was simply the Barbarian in Mid-South, and having this barbarian character with the cerebral Jake Roberts, it was actually really good. And when they turned Jake, they had John Nord turn on him and join Akbar's crew. But I actually thought they should have turned Nord with him, and they would have really, really gotten over.
I mean, I look back at that John Nord, and I see a guy with a ton of – I always thought Nord had a ton of potential, not always meaning probably up until when the WWF brought him in as the Berserker. I mean, once again, he wasn't a great worker, but he had some athleticism, and he was a huge guy, and he had a good look.
Yeah, there was something you could have done with him, and I still don't understand what the Berserker, like, you know, originally he was the Viking, and then they just changed his name to the Berserker, and they never really did anything with it. There was the angle where he tried to stab the Undertaker, and the sword went through the ring, and I don't remember anything else about that feud. I don't even remember any of the matches. I just remember that angle. But that was like around that time in like 92, right after Mania, which was like, you know, the last match of Hogan before his sabbatical, Sid Justice's last big moment before his drug test failure became public and he had to leave. The Warrior returns. And then they did Warrior Papa Shango, and they abandoned that as quickly as they could. after all the vomiting on TV, they really got away from that pretty quickly. And then you had the Berserker try to stab the Undertaker.
Yeah, the Berserker did this weird thing where he would throw guys out of the ring and win on count out, and you'd be like, wow, that's kind of different. But yeah, those were dark days for the WWF. Like, they had all their lead baby faces wearing t-shirts in the ring because they had a new steroid testing policy, and they all shrunk.
Yeah, I said before how WCW bottomed out in 91. WWF, it's more like 91, 92. Like, it's hard to really say. You know, there is some cool stuff, like Flair is there for that year, and I actually thought they used Flair pretty well. I shouldn't have lost the title to Randy Savage. You should have worked with Hogan. But all things considered, if you were a Ric Flair fan, you felt good during that run. Like, when he got there and he did the angle where him and Piper had problems and he took down Vince with the chair shot, and then they did him and Hogan, they rushed it to house shows, but he was, like, treated better, you know, better than he was in WCW almost for that one year.
There was a rumor, and it was a rumor in, like, the smart fan community. Usually, you know, when you hear something, it's true. This had to at least have been on the table, that Ric Flair was going to win the 92 Royal Rumble when he was number 30 and everyone else had eliminated everyone else. And he would come to the empty ring and be handed the title. And I don't know if they backed out on that at the last minute or if that was just a red herring, but that's the story that was going around.
That was in Albany in 1992. How do you think they would have reacted if they had gone with that finish for not just the match, but the entire pay-per-view event?
I don't think it would have been received too negatively because, hey, it's pro wrestling and they have screw jobs, but they would have absolutely taken away all of Ric Flair's credibility. What they actually did, having him go in number 3 and just put on a stellar performance, was the best thing they could have done.
Did you like Flair's return to WCW in 93?
Yes, I did. I felt like he had done everything that he needed to do in the WWF. It was pretty obvious to me that, you know, he was going to be brought further and further down the card in WWF. So it was kind of time for him to go. But I totally didn't like what they did with him when he first came back. I mean, he's Ric Flair, okay, but they bring him out for an interview and he has nothing to say because he doesn't have a program. It was ridiculous.
Well, they brought him back as like this babyface legend, you know, and he had just been there just a couple of years before, but they brought him back as like this distinguished babyface legend. And then they gave him his talk show, A Flair for the Gold, which was ridiculous. It was just
awful.
It was awful and it was ridiculous. And I guess the stuff that was cool was him and Arn working with the Blondes, but I'm not a fan of him and Vader, you know, which ended up at Starrcade that year after Sid tried to stab Arn Anderson or Arn Anderson tried to stab Sid. They tried to stab each other, apparently, because there were cuts everywhere. But after Sid got fired and he wasn't going to be in that match with Vader, they put Flair in there. I'm actually not a fan of that, of him working with Vader. I didn't like seeing like Ric Flair at that point. When he really got his ass kicked like Vader was doing, like he had a bloody mouth, I think, by the end of that match.
He knocked some of his teeth out.
Yeah, I didn't like seeing Flair like that. I didn't like that.
Well, Vader, I mean, you know, I keep hearing what a nice guy he is, but you know what? You can be a nice guy, but if you intentionally hurt people in the ring, you're an asshole. So there you go.
Yeah, you know, Vader was one of those guys. At the times, you got to say the Steiners would just kill people. Ron Garvin would just kill people.
It wasn't as bad with Garvin. I mean, I heard stories where the jobbers would get to the TV studio at WTBS and they'd see their names. Okay, you're matched up against either the Steiners or Vader, and they'd just go home.
Well, you can't blame them.
No, these guys got to go to work on Monday without a broken back.
Hey, you know, the Ric Flair discussion reminded me of something I thought about recently, which was, I think it may have been a thread in the Mothership group about Harley Race, about just why was the decision made to stick with Harley for the years they did and for as long as they did with as many reigns as they did? And I started thinking about it, like when Harley wins the title from Terry Funk, if it wasn't Harley, who was ready for that role? Who was ready to carry the NWA title for at least a good period of time between, you know, 1978 and 1981?
Brian, I have a top 10 for you this week.
Oh, we do have a top 10. Okay.
We have a top 10.
Sponsored by Ramsor Records, but let's hear your
there
top
There you 10. Go. Hey, those guys were great. When they came on, we're talking about Mid-Atlantic Wrestling in the 1970s. That was an excellent segment.
Yeah, man. He's a cool guy. You know, that's why I like Dolph Ramsor being a sponsor of the show. He's actually a fan.
So anyway, guys who are not on my list, I'll explain why. Let's say it's 1977 and you need a new NWA champion. You're looking at this guy being NWA champ for, I don't know, like 3 or 4 years. I would not consider Bob Backlund, only because he has plans in the WWF and, you know, you're still partners with Vince Sr., you're not taking his guy away. Nick Bockwinkel had turned down an opportunity in 1979 not to be NWA champion, but Paul Bosch approached him and said, you know, would you be interested in me throwing your name out there for consideration? And Nick thought about it and he said, no, I'm good with the job I have now. If it was 1978 and superstar Billy Graham was winding down from the WWF, there was a time I absolutely would have considered him, and then I kind of learned what was going on behind the scenes, that he was having some health and personal issues, so that would have taken him off the table. Jack Briscoe, another guy that, you know, if he wanted it, I would have considered him for it, but he didn't want it. He was done being NWA champion by the end of 1975. So those are guys who would have made my top 10, but...
Okay, and I agree with your reasoning behind those. So who's number 10 on your list?
Quick disclaimer. People are going to say, oh my God, that wouldn't have worked. Well, nothing is going to work until it does. There is an alternative universe where we're talking about someone else being who was NWA champion and me saying, yeah, Harley Race. And you're like, no, that guy with the weird hair and the spare tire around his stomach, that would have never worked, but it did. So number 10, Jerry Lawler.
You know, that was one of the issues which caused Jerry Jarrett to try to work with Vern Gagne, thinking that he'll have a better chance of getting the AWA title on Lawler than the NWA title. But I could understand the reluctance from the other promoters who had a vote. But all things considered, Lawler would have been an exceptional NWA champion for coming into town, being able to cut a heel promo, work a heel match. He was still pretty athletic at that time. You know, if we're talking the end of the 70s, we're talking before he even broke his leg. So he's really athletic still. I think Lawler, I wish more people would have considered him because it would have been interesting.
I think Lawler would have made an excellent NWA champion or an excellent WWF champion. The thing is, and it's like any other job, it's like, okay, are you willing to do this to get this job that's going to pay you as much as like Dr. J or Tom Seaver? You're making like $5,000-$6,000 a week as NWA champion. Jerry, you need to find the gym and make friends with a pharmacist. You got to improve that look. But if he can do that, even just improve his musculature by 10 or 20%, he would be a viable candidate. And he is the best promo in the history of the business.
Well, you know, he's definitely near the top of the list if he's not the best guy in the history of the business. And I agree with you. And his look definitely played a part of it because that's the thing. Tennessee wrestling kind of had a reputation for guys that didn't really look like stars that other territories would have necessarily. And Lawler is one of those guys. And if he had ever gone to a gym, who knows how different his career would have been.
True. I mean, you know, then again, that's part of what makes Jerry Lawler Jerry Lawler. You know, you just have to go with what he is. But again, you have to say to him, hey, if you want to be considered for this prime position, you just got to look a little bit better. You know, one hour in the gym, 3 days a week. Go for it, buddy.
All right. So who's number 9 on your list?
Number 9, Wahoo McDaniel.
Huh. So we're talking, let's see, Terry won the title December 10th, 75. He lost it, what, February 78? Or was it 77?
It was 77.
77. Wahoo in 77. It's interesting. What's your reasoning?
Okay, well, for one, he was a huge name. He had a legit NFL background. He, you know, played for the Jets. He was, at that time, he was a good worker. So I thought he had all the components. One thing, you know, like Lawler, I would be like, you know, through one of his friends, I would be, you know, like, please tell Wahoo he will be considered for this prime spot if he could lose about 10 pounds. But other than that, he was a great promo, too. He got over everywhere he went.
And you're right about his credentials, and he's someone who we would see could work heel, can work babyface, real athlete, real athletic background. That's actually a pretty good pick.
Right, a really tough guy in real life, too.
Right, he would be NWA champion until he beat up a bunch of guys in a bar, and then they would force the title off him or something.
Because they looked at him the wrong way.
Unless it was in Mid-South, and he would win a trophy and a bonus, you know, if that had happened. But that's number 9, Wahoo. Who's number 8?
Dick Murdoch.
Huh. That's one where, huh, it's kind of crazy.
Oh, you hate it.
It's not that I hate it, but I don't know. It's just so different than the way I see Dick Murdoch. And I'm a big Dick Murdoch fan. But, you know, in 1977, he's in better shape, obviously, than he would be in 1985. He's still relatively young.
Mm-hmm.
He can work babyface. He can work heel. And he's a great worker. I wonder if the physique issue comes into play again here.
Yeah, he's a guy you'd like to have in a little bit better shape. But then again, in real life, we could say that about Harley Race. By like 1980, Race really needs to lose some weight. No offense if you're listening, Harley.
Yeah, what a career move. I'm going to gain weight and get a perm.
I'm going to dye it funny colors, but my facial hair will be different than the perm.
How does Harley Race get a perm? Excuse me, I want a permanent. Like, how does that happen? But Murdoch, I mean, in terms of what he could do in the ring, Murdoch would fit.
I mean, I saw a match with him and Antonio Inoki, and it was like a 4.5-star match. It was crazy good. So, I mean, the guy could do it. It's just a question of, you know, the knock on Murdoch has always been he's always got to get his clown spots in. He insists on it. And, again, you have leverage in this negotiation. It's like, Dick, you're going to be making a ton of money. Just don't do that.
Problem is, I don't know if that would be an effective argument against Dick Murdoch. He kind of just wanted to do what he wanted to do. And that's why he did those clown spots, is because he actually enjoyed them.
Oh, Dick Murdoch is one of the craziest people I've ever been around. I was in a restaurant, not just with him, but like with 12 other guys. And if Dick had something to say in this restaurant to someone clear across the room, he would just yell it out. he was the least self-conscious person I've ever been around. But he was funny, man. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, actually, we may be doing a segment pretty soon on the show about Dick Murdoch. So I'll keep everyone posted about that. But that was number 8. Number 7 on your list.
Number 7, Ted DiBiase.
See, I think if you're going to make the argument for DiBiase as NWA champion, you can't do it that early.
Here's my argument. The guy could do it all. He was an unbelievable in-ring tactician. He was a big guy. He was excellent at promos, both as a babyface and a heel. The problem with DiBiase is I remember when he debuted for the WWF in March 1979. I'm like, I don't know who this guy is. I remember seeing a picture of him wrestling Dick Murdoch in one of the After mags, and the article was about Murdoch, and just DiBiase was the opponent. That was all I knew about this guy. However, if you were a fan of world-class wrestling, and one day this guy Ric Flair comes on and he's the world's heavyweight champion, you've never heard of him unless you've read about him in magazines. So you would have that obstacle of introducing Ted DiBiase to almost each and every territory, but the upside is this guy was great.
I wouldn't go for that at that time. I recently been watching a lot of Mid-South, so more than ever before, I'm probably on a kick of thinking DiBiase was absolutely NWA title material between 81 and 85, 86. Even though, you know, by 86, you know, no one outside of Crockett was getting that title. But you know what I'm saying? That period of time.
I do.
I don't see it that early. I feel like when you get to 81, when you start getting DiBiase in a suit, when DiBiase shows that he's an amazing heel. I mean, that's the other thing. When he finally reveals that in 82. That he's an amazing heel. That's when you really see, like, okay, this guy can be a babyface. He can be a heel. He can work the great matches. DiBiase's like an underrated in-ring brawler, but he could do that style too if he has to. I just wouldn't say in 77 it would have, you know, unless it was something like a fluke thing and then you introduce him to every territory. But I don't know how that would have worked back then.
Well, I mean, you had to do it sometimes. And I guess the nature of this conversation is, wow, it really is a small pool of candidates that you can actually put this belt on. You have to be so elite to be NWA champion. Personally, there was talk that, more than talk, that Ted DiBiase was supposed to win the NWA title in 1981. I think he was supposed to get what Dusty got. And Dusty politicked around that. But I personally think that DiBiase was more valuable in 78 than he was in 81. And let me walk you through this.
Yeah, I want to hear this.
Okay. When he went to the WWF, he was not a top guy. You got to remember, WWF programming, you know, it got covered in the magazines, it was on WOR, and he was presented as a mid-carder in WWF. Here's a guy who went to a draw with Jerry Valiant on TV. So to me, it's hard to put an NWA title on a guy who was just doing that on national cable 2 years ago.
I don't know. This is the big one I'm disagreeing with you on.
That's all right.
Out of all of them so far. Number seven? Number seven. We have a problem. But who's number six?
Number six is Dusty Rhodes.
You know what? That one, I think, out of all the ones so far, makes a lot of sense. It would have been so radically different than everyone who had ever been NWA champion. But I think at that period of time, 77, you know, and let's include 78 into this just to do it, he would have been a good fit to be WWF champion or NWA champion.
They would have had to change the formula a little bit because Dusty would have been sort of, as NWA champion, I think he would have been reluctant to work total heel, which I don't blame him. They just would have had to present the NWA title differently, where the top heel in the promotion is going after the NWA title rather than the top babyface pretty much always going after it.
While we're talking about this, though, since I did bring it up, what do you think about Dusty if they had had him instead of Backlund beat Billy Graham?
I have the feeling that I think Backlund long-term was the better choice. I think Dusty might have burned out in the Northeast in like 2 or 3 years. But then again, you would have gotten a good 2 or 3 years out of him, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, Backlund was burnt to a crisp by fall 1982, so.
It would have changed Dusty's career, too, because in terms of politics, he wouldn't have been able to make the headway that he made working with and for Eddie Graham if he had been working for Vince McMahon Sr., all those years. He wouldn't have become so powerful politically, I don't think.
No, probably not. But I'll tell you this. I was a WWF fan when Dusty had his run here in 1977 and 1978. He was barely on television. And sometimes when he was on television, they were showing clips from Florida. And he got over like crazy as a babyface. I mean, like crazy.
Yeah. I mean, Dusty's one of those guys, when you go back and you look, after the babyface turn in 74... everywhere he went, he just becomes this huge attraction. Detroit, Texas, the WWF, Georgia, every single place, he just becomes this major attraction. AWA. I mean, it's really extraordinary. And, you know, that's why Dusty's on that list with Andre, is that those attractions in the 70s that in many ways, Dusty didn't need a title. And I know he wanted the title and he got his three short reigns, but Dusty really didn't need a title.
No, he didn't, but Dusty always cracked me up that he would one of these days I'm going to take the time and research this. How many times did Dusty lose a title without losing a match?
Well, yeah, that's true, too.
I mean, countless, but still, and you know, at some point that got old.
Yeah, well, you know, how many times did a guy win a match and not win a title when Dusty was booking? I mean, it's just...
Oh, God.
There's all this arithmetic when it comes to Dusty being in charge. Dusty loses the belt but doesn't lose the match, and then everyone else wins the match but doesn't win the belt.
Well, Dusty did plenty of that, too.
Yeah. All right, number six. Number five on your list.
Stan Hansen.
See, that's an interesting one. 77 is... after the Bruno incident,
mm-hmm.
Where did he go next? Did he go to Georgia? I don't remember. He went to Georgia next. Huh. Because it's kind of like with Hansen, it's around 81 that he kind of, I shouldn't say that, maybe 1980, he kind of becomes the Stan Hansen we know. You know, he's a little different during the run against Bruno. But by 1980, he becomes Stan Hansen. Huh, I don't know. 1977, he would have been a touring champion. He could have worked heel everywhere, obviously.
Stan Hansen was a very effective babyface, too, which really surprised me when I saw like the 1979 clips from Georgia. But people got behind him, and he could work either style. He could do a great babyface promo. We all know he did a great heel promo. I hated what the AWA did with him. With the tobacco juice and just the crazy redneck cowboy thing, he was way better as just a sinister dark heel.
You have to think, too, if he was the NWA champion and touring all the territories, he would be the first NWA champion in history to hurt his opponent every night of the week because he was blind and he was stiff.
He wasn't as bad in the 80s as he was in the 90s. He was killing guys in Japan in the 90s.
It's an interesting pick. I don't know if I would go with Hansen in 77, but it's not completely crazy. Again, though, he hadn't really established himself yet, so it really would have been him establishing himself beyond the Bruno incident as champion. You would have been, what, a year and a half away from the Bruno incident, so it's still fresh in people's mind. You're capitalizing on that. He's in the news. It's I don't know, I'm kind of convincing myself as I'm saying this.
Yeah, the Bruno incident happened in April of 1976, and so that would have been fresh on people's minds. When Hansen came back in 81, people still totally – he actually came back in 1980, and people totally remembered that up here.
Yeah, it also shows you why if you were going to make him champion, you had to do it before he had his strong Japanese contacts, because when he came back, he never did a job anywhere to anyone.
Nope.
So
no, he got to make his own rules.
Okay, that was what, number five?
Number five.
What's number four? Who's number four?
Number four is Dick Slater.
Huh. See, that's another crazy one I hadn't thought about.
And another guy who worked both styles, got over both as a babyface and a heel.
But you would be having Dick Slater replace Terry, you know, be right after Terry Funk? That you know, that's the only thing that may be a little weird just because of the style similarities.
Yeah, Dick Slater actually was very much like Terry Funk. The more I think about it, if you saw Dick Slater after if you only saw him after his WWF run, you think I'm absolutely crazy. Something happened to him where like he lost all of his talent in the WWF. Before that, Dick Slater was a major star everywhere he went. He was the top heel in Mid-South, Mid-Atlantic, Georgia, Southwest, Florida. I mean, that's pretty much everywhere. And so everyone, you know, he definitely had the talent to be a top guy. Now we're talking about him being the top guy. I think it would have worked.
You know, the WWF run really did kill him because in 85, when he was booking Mid-South and he was there with Dark Journey and he was aligned with Buzz Sawyer, that was awesome. He was great there.
Yes.
And then he leaves there to go there and they make him the rebel. And it's just, like, who's rooting for this guy? No one is. And that killed him because I know, he was in WCW at various points. Him and Greg Valentine were like the U.S. Tag Team Champions maybe in like 1992. And him and Bunkhouse Buck were Tag Team Champions. But it's like that after that run, Dick Slater is a completely different wrestler.
He is. When they brought him in 1989, I was like, yes, Dick Slater. And this guy, the ghost of Dick Slater, shows up on my TV.
Well, that was the case with a lot of guys in 89. Like, what about – and Bob Orton's a great worker. He was great before. He was great after. Well, when Bob Orton shows up in 89, and he's a different guy. And it took Butch Reed a while to get going in 89. You know, it was a lot of those guys bounced out of the WWF and just – I don't know if it was their motivation or if – you know, not that the motivation was gone, but just their motivation for what they wanted to do in the ring was different after working every single night that WWF style.
Oh, I'm sure they had, instilled in them the WWF mindset where when you went into the ring, your job was to not get hurt and to make it to the next town.
Slater's interesting though in 77. He's a young guy, but he's already shown he could really work, could do babyface or heel. He had been in Florida. He had been in Georgia with Bob Orton Jr. as a tag team, I believe, already by that point. Not crazy. I mean, the only issue I have is just the style similarities to the NWA champion Terry Funk, who he would be replacing, but not a crazy choice.
I mean, he was – Meltzer told me that he was once under consideration to actually win the NWA title. I'm not sure what the time frame was on that, but I was definitely told that.
Who's number three on your list?
Greg Valentine.
That I could see.
He was a top star everywhere he went. Valentine might have been the top heel in wrestling from, let's say, if 1975 through 1984 was a decade, I would go with Greg Valentine as the top heel in the business. I mean, he drew money everywhere he went. He was a top star everywhere he went. I literally thought he was going to win the WWF title from Bob Backlund in 1981. So that's how high I think of him.
I think, too, if you're going to give the NWA title to Greg Valentine, that's an interesting time to give it to him. You know, you can't do it too late. That's a very interesting one. And I think because so much of his later career was seen by so many people when he could still have good matches, but very often he didn't. It was like the ghost of Greg Valentine, like you said about Dick Slater. For like, you know, the second, you know, from 1986 on, it was the ghost of Greg Valentine in the WWF with, you know, a few exceptions. But before then, it's like it's easy to forget just how good he was in Mid-Atlantic because the other part of his career wasn't like that.
No, not at all. I mean, I remember being taken aback that, like, wow, Greg Valentine is now just this tag team guy. He's like one of the – he's like the Iron Sheik or Nikolai Volkoff or Jim Brunzel. And I always saw him as a major, major star before that. But, yeah, right around 88, 89 – Valentine was in the argument for maybe not the worst worker, but he was right up there. He was terrible by then.
Although I did like him and Ron Garvin, there was something about that I did get a kick out of. But that's a good one, and that's number three. So he's pretty high up on your list. There's only two remaining. Who's your number two pick to replace Harley Race during those years as NWA champion?
Ric Flair.
Well, I don't know what to say about that. Ric Flair as NWA champion in 77. What's your argument for giving it to him that early?
He was a phenomenal worker, probably best in the business. I mean, we've seen the Cornette Mid-Atlantic tapes, and you just look at Flair, and this guy is moving in fast forward the whole time. You know, he was a great promo when they actually did give him the title in 1981. He got over like $1 million. I to this day, I think they waited too long to put the NWA title on Ric Flair. They could have easily put it on him in 79, and we're only going back a couple of years here.
On this topic, and we've talked a lot about Ric Flair today, what are your thoughts about him losing the title back to Harley to set up Starrcade 83? Do you think it should have been Harley in that role? Do you think something else should have been done? What are your thoughts about that?
I remember coming home from a baseball game in 1983, so I missed my world-class wrestling in the morning, and I got a phone call, and someone told me that Harley Race had regained the NWA title, and I was like, you're ribbing me, right? And he's like, no. I thought, to me personally, this is not a knock on Harley Race, but I was so bored with him as NWA champion by the time he lost the belt in 1981 for good, and it just felt like, oh my God, I couldn't think of a worse person they could put it back on. I think they should have gone with someone else, whether it be Dick Slater or Greg Valentine, anyone.
I am not a fan of the Starrcade 83 match. I know it was match of the year in the Observer, but I've always hated that match. From the botched crossbody at the end to Gene Kaniski as the referee. And the weird camera angles. I've never, ever been a fan of that match. The one thing I did like about Harley's run in 83 was when, what was the scheduled match? Was it David versus Flair? And it was when Flair lost the title, so Harley went into world class as the champion, which I always thought was kind of cool because world class is like almost like its own entity at this time. They have the touring NWA champion, but they have all their own things going on. But the NWA champion is like a regular character on their show. Flair is as much a part of the world class show as he is Mid-Atlantic in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
And when all of a sudden Flair loses the title, it's like this outside incident happened. And now Harley Race, who they knew, who had a history with the family, who had, you know, been on that Texas Stadium show where Fritz retired against Kerry Von Erich, all of a sudden Harley's back as the NWA champion. It actually did have credibility with those fans. I did. That's the one thing I did like. And who do you remember who he worked with? It would have been the summer Star Wars in 83.
I think it was Kevin Von Erich, where they had the deal where Kevin blew out his shoulder in the middle of the match and David came out. I think that was June 17th, 1983.
Yeah, I just looked it up, John. You're actually exactly right. June 17th, 83, the Reunion Arena, 21,000 sold out. It was Harley beating Kevin via DQ. That would have been Flair. And then the other big attraction that night was Kerry and Bruiser Brody making his return against the Freebirds for the American Tag Titles.
That was phenomenal. Michael Hayes going over the list of potential tag team partners for Kerry. And we know it's not Dusty Rhodes because he's too fat.
There's something so special about 83 world class, especially those Star Wars events, just the look of them, just the size of the crowds, and the production was like nothing anyone had ever seen in wrestling before, but it still holds up all these years later. Like peak world class look wise, production wise, still holds up.
Definitely. And it was such a different product than really anything out there. You've got these guys in their early 20s in the main events. They're showing main events on TV. It was like, you know, it was just the first Rock and Wrestling connection, to be honest with you.
Okay, so we're up to your number one pick. So I'm going to try to guess real quick based on who you haven't put in.
I was going to request that you guess, so go ahead.
If we look at what's happening in California, the two big stars are Chavo and Piper. I don't think you would have picked either one of them. If we look at Portland, that would have been the Jesse Ventura era. I don't think there's anyone there you would have picked. If we look at who's on top in the AWA, obviously Nick Bockwinkel would have been the perfect guy as NWA champion. I don't know if you would have picked him because he was AWA champion, so I won't pick him.
I wouldn't have gone with Bockwinkel because I thought he looked too old in 1978.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. I don't think you would have picked Stevens at that point. Patterson would be an interesting pick, but I don't think you'll pick Pat Patterson. Billy Robinson, no. It wouldn't be Brunzell or Gagne. It wouldn't be the Crusher or the Bruiser. I can guarantee that. Wouldn't be the Sheik in Detroit. You already had Dusty on the list from Florida. Also in Florida, 77, Steve Kern is a rookie. Mike Graham, you wouldn't pick. Bob Roop is there. I don't think you'd pick Bob Roop. Ron Fuller is running Southeastern. I don't think you would pick Ron Fuller. In Texas, Devon Erics, Kevin, I think, debuts at the end of the year or during that year. Too young, so you can't pick any of the Von Erics. You're not picking Fritz. You're not picking Gino, who's just starting out. You're not picking Bill Watts, I don't think.
I thought about Watts, but he didn't make the top 10.
At some point, he would have been a good NWA champion because of his promo ability, just that alone.
He would have been a great NWA champion in the early 70s, a great NWA champion.
Can you imagine? And we have a video right here sent in from the NWA champion, Bill Watts, and it's a video of him just, you know, being himself. You know, it would have been great. Who am I forgetting? So if we look at the WWF, you already mentioned Backlund and Billy Graham earlier. It wouldn't be Bruno. It wouldn't be Chief J. Strongbow. I don't think...
Chief J. Strongbow, no.
Yeah, I don't think you'd go with Gorilla. Rick Martel wasn't really on anyone's radar exactly yet. So you're going to pick someone, and I'm going to get it wrong. In Atlanta, Tommy Rich isn't there yet. Wrestling 2, you wouldn't pick. I give up. Who's your number one pick for your choice to replace Harley Race's NWA champion in those years between 1977 and 1981?
Ken Patera.
Huh. See, that's actually... I hadn't thought about him at all. That's a great choice.
I think to this day, he would have been a way better choice than Harley Race. At this point, he had just found his groove as a heel. He had been wrestling in the AWA as a babyface before finding the hair dye and going to the WWF, where he really found himself. He had a natural, arrogant heel persona. He was a fantastic worker. He had the credentials of participating in the Olympics and the Pan Am Games. He had the gimmick of the strongest man in the world, and he had it all.
Patera's a guy I could see in that role in 81. I could see him in that role in 83 even. But even that early in 77, I think that would be a good pick. That's actually a very good pick.
I think it would have worked out better in reality than it would in fantasy. When he was in Georgia in 1981, I mean, we always talk about Patera, Snuka, and Gordy out there. But Patera was the guy who, to me, came across as someone who was an absolute superstar who could have carried, you know, the NWA or WWF titles.
Well, there you go. Ken Patera. That's interesting. We should do this again. We'll come up with a topic, and I'll let you come up with a list, and we'll talk about it. That's interesting. The only ones I really... vehemently disagreed with you on were DiBiase in 77. I didn't see Murdoch. Were those the two big ones? Yeah, I guess
those were the two big ones. Now, do you think there's anyone really missing from here? Or
yeah, that's what I was trying to think, too. I mean, if you wanted to go with some international flavor, you know, potentially someone from Japan, although I don't know if Jumbo Tsuruta as a touring NWA champion would have worked well.
I don't think it would have. I hate to say that because Tsuruta was so friggin' good.
Yeah,
and, you know, he was a big guy, but I don't think it would have worked.
If you look at what's happening in Canada, like, I don't see any of those guys that were part of the big war a couple years earlier, like the Rougeaus or the Vachons. I don't think they would have been a good fit. You need someone who can main event St. Louis. I hate to simplify
it. Patera did.
And Patera did. Patera was Missouri State champion. So, yeah, interesting. Good picks. Good picks. That was fun.
Thank you, sir.
Well, let's move on from there. I want to mention something. I brought up Bruno before. My dad, last week in his segment, mentioned that he remembered Arnold Skoland and he thought he was Bruno's uncle. And I said, no, that was wrong. Maybe you're talking about Bruno's cousin. And I think I said Dominic DiNucci, which was wrong. It was actually Tony Parisi, or Antonio Pugliese, as some people may know him. John, were you watching already when him and Louis Cerdan were tag team champions?
That is when I first started watching regularly.
What did you think of them?
I thought they were kind of lame, to be honest with you. It almost came across to me, even as a kid, as, oh, these guys are on TV because one of them's Bruno's cousin.
I actually recently saw a match with them, and I enjoyed it for what it was, for like that mid-70s television style. But I definitely was thinking, like, these guys are so generic in that, like, hey, here are the big, you know, we're from Italy and we're going to smile and wait. Like, it was like a generic baby face, even in that time. It was just, they were two just generic baby faces as a tag team, united by their common ancestry.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one was Bruno's cousin, but it was one of them. It was either Parisi or Cerdan. I'm starting to think it's Cerdan now, but I don't know.
Well, there's that clarification.
That was actually my first title switch when the Executioners came in and they announced the TV before that the Executioners were getting the big title match. I was all excited about it. And then the Executioners did the switcheroo. They cheated with that no good Lou Albano and they won the titles. I was like, wow, titles change hands.
When did you first get into Albano?
Oh, right away. Especially when Strongbow showed up. Like, Albano struck me as this is like this really evil, manipulative manager, which means he was doing his job correctly. And when Strongbow and White Wolf came in, it was actually White Wolf was already there. When Strongbow came out of the audience to wrestle, to save Billy White Wolf from the Executioners, that was the moment I got hooked into being a wrestling fan. We might not be having this conversation today if that didn't happen.
Wow, so God bless Killer Kowalski trying to hide his bald head under that mask. But, hey, John, we're going to move on to the next segment, and that is going to be Slaughtering a Sacred Cow. We have Alan Blackstock talking about Bruiser Brody, and we'll talk to you about that a little bit, too. But do you have a sacred cow you want to slaughter?
I do. I enjoyed them. They provided a ton of entertainment for me. I paid money to go see them, but the Four Horsemen were a net negative.
Wow, that's a pretty big statement, and I'm surprised you're saying it. Actually, I didn't think that you were on that side of things.
I am not just going to slaughter a sacred cow. This sacred cow is pregnant, and I'm taking the babies away.
I think it may have been Howard Baum, John, on the show a little while back, maybe a few weeks back, who said that that was actually his sacred cow, was that Ric Flair was better before the Horsemen, and that the Horsemen held him back. So why don't you go into some of your thoughts here?
Okay, I definitely agree with that. Ric Flair should have been Ric Flair, not part of one of four guys who are running around doing all of this. I thought they brought Ric Flair down a little bit. When the concept started to get old, they refused to get away from it. And that's a big thing. I'll get back into that in a minute. But when you had the Four Horsemen, first of all, you have four unbelievably cool heels. That helps kill the rest of the heel roster, and it keeps the baby faces from getting over. They were just too cool. Then when the concept started to get old, you notice the Four Horsemen were on top as JCP burned to the ground. That's not the reason, but it's one reason. It created this ceiling where you could only get over so much. Then when Tully and Arn both started getting stale, you could turn Arn Anderson, but there's no way you can use Tully Blanchard as a babyface. So now you've got stale Tully. It has to be one of the four top guys in the promotion, so none of the other heels are getting over now. And again, it might not have been their fault, but towards the end of 88, they needed to get rid of it, and they kept holding on for dear life. They were talking about, as I said earlier, maybe making Butch Reed a horseman. They had Kendall Windham as a junior horseman. Get out of here. And finally, when Windham, oh my God, I haven't even talked about Matsuda, but when J.J. Dillon left, they brought in the invisible manager, Hiro Matsuda, the anti Lou Albano. And then when Tully and Arn left, I really thought now and at the time, it was a blessing in disguise because they could finally get away from that. And yet they kept clinging on to it with Flair, Windham, Matsuda, and who will be the two new horsemen? They were talking about putting the Road Warriors in the Four Horsemen. So that's how – it was almost like they were addicted to the concept. I'll go further with it, slaughtering the sacred cow. I thought Eric Bischoff promoted the Four Horsemen the right way, with a few exceptions. There were times he buried Flair when he didn't need to bury Flair, but at that point, he kind of had acts ahead of the Four Horsemen, and in a way, it sort of felt like a nostalgia act, and that was the way to do it in 1995 and 1996.
The issues you brought up with them being the cool heels, so impossible for the babyfaces to get over them, how much of that do you think was responsible for the fans turning on Dusty versus Dusty's actual booking?
Good question. I think, actually, I don't think it had much to do with it, because I think by the end of 1985, the fans had started to turn on Dusty because they just liked Flair better, and you know the Four Horsemen hadn't formulated yet. But when they did the cage angle in the Omni, where the Andersons and Ric Flair messed up Dusty Rhodes, I thought they made the wrong move. Flair was the babyface, and the fans did not want to boo him.
That's a problem going forward always. You know, I mean, think about if things had been different in 88, if Tully and Arn had turned on Ric Flair at that point, maybe then Tully wouldn't be stale. Maybe then, you know, you do something different with Flair. Maybe then, you know, the fans react a little differently in those towns because now you have babyface fired up Flair.
I mean, they wanted Lex Luger to be their Hulk Hogan. I mean, from day one, that was the plan. They were going to make him a horseman, turn him babyface, and try to have him be their top attraction. I always thought that was a mistake. If you had a Four Horsemen of Lex Luger, Barry Windham, Tully Blanchard, and Arn Anderson feuding with Ric Flair, Sting, Pillman, whoever, I think that would have been box office.
Howard Baum said that he thought Flair was at his best when he had the butterfly on his tights. What do you think of that?
I'm not too sure about that. But you know what? I mean, we're talking 1980, 1981 Flair, when he was a babyface in Mid-Atlantic, and he was so good in that role.
It's a sacred cow you're slaughtering, but I've heard more and more people voicing that opinion lately. So you may be
that it was a net negative?
That the Four Horsemen, I don't want to say overrated, but just that, you know, really, what were they? I mean, it was something I think a lot of fans remember them as just being too cool for school versus how did it really affect the business?
Yeah, I mean, there are a million reasons why JCP burned to the ground. But, I mean, the Horsemen did not help the situation. Another thing, Flair didn't help the situation by insisting on being a heel. If you go back to late 1989, early 1990, when they first brought back Arn Anderson, they put Ole in the mix. I mean, the reactions those guys were getting as babyfaces was phenomenal. And yet they had to turn them because Flair felt like he as a heel was the guy who was going to get Sting up to Hogan's level, which I think he just liked being a heel.
That's the problem. And the thing is, someone needed to at some point say, okay, Rick, be a heel, but you're going to be a babyface. You know, just you don't have to change. Just keep being you, but you're going to be a babyface because they're going to cheer
gonna
you anyway.
Put you against the bad guys.
Well, John, that's your sacred cow. Alan Blackstock has a sacred cow. Now, Alan was on a few weeks back, and it was a segment that got a lot of attention, where he said that he didn't think Dean Malenko was a good worker. And it got a lot of reactions. Some people said, hey, I've been saying this for years, and other people said, you're crazy. Well, we'll see what they say this week, because Alan's going to give his point of view. He's going to slaughter a sacred cow, and his sacred cow is Bruiser Brody. The last time Alan Blackstock was on the show, he slaughtered a sacred cow and talked about why he does not like Dean Malenko and why he thought you shouldn't either, and it got a hell of a reaction. So with that said, Alan Blackstock is back on the show this week. Alan, welcome back to the Super Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, and I'm hungry, Brian. I'm hungry to slaughter another sacred cow, you know, where Dean Malenko is only a small one. I think we're going to go for something a little bit meatier, a little bit bigger this time around.
Now, I got to ask you before we go forward, because you say we're going to something bigger than Dean Malenko. These are your true thoughts. You're not trying to be outrageous or anything for the show. This is truly what you believe. It's just you're very passionate about it.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm not going to say anything for the sake of saying it. These are people that have irked me for some time. Something kind of spur of the moment thing. So the people that I do discuss, if, you know, I come on again in the future, is guys that I generally think, well, they're not that great, really. What's all the fuss? What's all the hype? What's the point? You know, they've been put as this mythical figure for a reason. I kind of break that down why I don't think they are. So this guy is someone who I'm going to do a good job at that, hopefully, as well.
Having said that, Alan, what is the sacred cow you wish to slaughter this week?
Well, it's the man who's got an award named after him in the Wrestling Observer End of Year Awards, and that's one Bruiser Brody. He's someone for me. I just want to preface this by saying, Brian, he's not horrible. I don't think he's absolutely horrible by any means. I think he could sometimes have, you know, an entertaining brawl. But if you meet someone like Dave Meltzer, you would think he was a phenom who was beyond description when it came to being a pro wrestler. I just got a point here. Adrian Adonis, unfortunately, he passed away in 1988, Brian, as you know. The July the 11th newsletter, Wrestling Observer, it didn't hardly get much of an obit. I mean, it was a couple of pages. Bruiser Brody gets a 7-page eulogy, you know, 1 month later. And obviously some of that is because of his death, which is unfortunate. And that's not something that comes into anything to do with my argument here whatsoever. I just want to mention that as well. But he kind of mentions in that he was an all-time great. And this is at a time when most fans haven't seen much other than what they grew up with. So it's easy to see how someone like Meltzer as an influence could really inflate Brody's worth, you know, to the viewership or the audience that would read The Observer. And it basically did help generate this myth that he was this legendary worker. And I think the timing of that is quite important because in 1988, Meltzer had a sizable audience, like I said, that, you know, the footage wasn't available for them. The tape trading scene hadn't kicked off until, you know, the late, you know, 80s, early 90s. So Meltzer pushing this guy and naming an award after him early on, you know, in 88, you know, when he passed away, is really going to cement him as someone who people think should be, you know, this fantastic guy. I mean, look at Dynamite Kid versus Tiger Mask. The idea that was a great match, you know, I'm not saying it wasn't, but it's been hardwired into the minds of at least, you know, two generations of wrestling fans that is, you know, a top-notch match. And even if you haven't seen it, you're going to kind of parrot that to people to kind of seem that you're more knowledgeable. And I think that comes from, you know, Meltzer. I think, honestly, if Brody didn't die, you would have seen him in WCW in the mid-early 90s doing like an Abdullah the Butcher thing coming out of a box, you know, something of that nature. You know, his brawling style, you'd think, you know, he wouldn't be much better than like a Jim Duggan or something like that. It's just like Meltzer has been putting him overtime in to get him in as an all-time great. And I think that's a real major point for me. For me as a worker, as Brody, I just don't think he's that great whatsoever. I think he's missing something. I think his holds aren't great. He doesn't make it compelling. He doesn't really give me a struggle. Show me more fighting pain or selling, which is a major, major problem I've got with Brody as well. He just never really did it for me. And I think the one thing with Brody, he would sell for certain guys, and that with guys like Dory Funk, Giant Baba. Wonder why he'd sell for those guys. That's obviously because, you know, they're his bosses. They're the people that were getting in bookings or, you know, were promoting All Japan at the time. That was the exception to the rule. Generally, 95% of the time, he was making a conscious decision not to sell for people. So basically, 95% of the time, he was actually choosing to have a worse match than he possibly could have. And how can that be someone that's an all-time great if they're actually actively, you know, planning to do that? And I've got some examples of this, Brian, as well. I don't want to kind of say these sort of things and not back them up. I mean, there's a match that I watched. It was Giant Baba and Jumbo Tsuruta versus Brody and Snuka in 1981. It was a 2 out of 3 falls match. And Baba gets in the ring and Brody's selling for him. And then Jumbo gets in. Fuck that. He's not giving him any love whatsoever. He's, you know, he gets straight up from a gut-wrench suplex. There's a double big boot spot as well with Baba and Jumbo. He gets straight up from that. It just basically doesn't make things credible compared to the other guys that are selling. And I think that really is a detriment for me. And, you know, for him as well, and the major thing I've got a problem with him as well, he was more or less blackballed from the NWA, so we never really saw him at a time which could have been his peak of drawing, you know, in JCP, or he never had a run against Hogan with Vince up in WWF. And I think, you know, while Flair and Hogan and the actual all-time greats were drawing these 10,000, you know, plus gates. You saw Brody was knocking around in Kansas, Central States, drawing, you know, not big crowds because, you know, no one of any credibility or any decent, you know, business acumen would actually touch him with a barge pole. And, you know, another example, I mean, I watched the Bruiser Brody Abdullah the Butcher match to prepare for this from 81 as well. I think that was April the 10th. And the whole brawl is them getting their hands around each other. That's it, the entire brawl. And the difference with Brody and, you know, and Abdullah the Butcher character is Abby actually delivered on his character and Brody, I didn't feel, did. Brody would come to the ring and he'd be swinging the chain like a nut and he'd be thinking that he's going to go totally out of control and then he'd sort of wrestle, but not. Whereas Abby, throughout any point, he's stabbing people with forks, he's an absolute lunatic, he's just doing the choke and he's just doing what a madman would do. And there's, you know, a disconnect there for me with, you know, someone like Bruiser Brody. And I think another thing, you know, getting back to Dave, Brian, as well, is he was a major source for Dave. You got to remember this. I mean, it was through Larry Madisick, I think, who got him inside. And then, you know, Brody wasn't a stranger to journalism, you know, from his background working on the papers in, you know, the early 70s. He'd have an influence on Dave. And I think Dave is clouded by that influence. I mean, I would put Brody in some ways, see, I'm not completely knocking him, on par with a Dick Murdoch. I mean, in that way, that's because you never knew what you were going to get from either guy. You sometimes would get these great matches. And I think someone that Dory goes who got the sorry, who got the best out of Bruiser Brody was Dory Funk Jr. There's a couple of matches from the early 80s where, you know, like I said, he would sell for him. So if he's going to sell for him, the matches, in my opinion, are going to be better. It's going to be more credible. I can buy into it more. So that's really who I think his best opponent is. Another thing with Brody, he was over in Japan. I am not going to say he was not over in Japan, but let's just look at it for a minute. All Japan drew more with Choshu than it did with Brody. And then they draw more with Tenryu than they did opposing Jumbo as well. And then they drew more with Misawa as opposed to Jumbo than, you know, anyone else, including Brody. And also, New Japan did more on top with Ishigun than, you know, with Brody on top. And they drew far more in the 90s. Obviously, Brody passed away than they ever did in the 80s. I just think it's an overstatement to say how big Bruiser Brody actually is overall. I mean, there's people who have this Bruiser Brody Jim Duggan comparison. And people forget that Brody was Duggan's mentor at some point during his career. And I think Brody and Duggan as brawlers, I don't think Bruiser Brody's any better than, say, Hacksaw Jim Duggan as a brawler, but we're not going to name the Hacksaw Jim Duggan Award for the best brawler of the year. And I think it's overstated. I mean, Meltzer spoke as Brody as was the Johnny Valentine of his generation. I mean, he puts it over someone that you'd believed it was real when you knew that wrestling wasn't in fact real. And, you know, I think that's completely overstating the actual point, because if he's not selling, he's undermining the offense of the other guys. So how can that be credible, these stiff kicks that, you know, people are delivering to him? I mean, don't get me wrong, it wasn't bad throughout his career. He was entertaining. He had a great run in 1987 in World Class. And I think some of that, when it's a team play, was, you know, one match that stands out to me against Buzz Sawyer, which I think was fantastic. And that was because Brody was selling. He was selling because he was like a booker of the promotion. You know, he was involved behind the scenes. He did that infamous shoot interview where he talks kind of candidly, which is really cool. If people want to seek that out, that's on YouTube. It was kind of one of the early, if not the earliest, kind of shoot interview genre. That was before Eddie Gilbert by about 5 years. I think that was pretty cool to do. But I think he wasn't even a good booker. I mean, he was ousted, you know, as the booker of World Class as well. So all in all, Brian, I don't know if you want to chime in at any point here, but I just think he's overstated for those reasons I mentioned.
You listed a lot of reasons. So I don't know where to start. Let's go back to one of the main things I've talked about in the past. You brought up Dynamite Kid versus Tiger Mask and how you couldn't watch it now and think it's this great match. Or maybe that's not exactly how you phrased it, but, you know. And again, I go back to, you have to watch it within the context of 1983. And if you were someone who grew up in the Northeast and you're watching a WWF house show or WWF TV and you get your first tape of Japan and one of the first things you see is Tiger Mask versus Dynamite Kid, that may be the greatest thing you've ever seen. You have to look at it through 1983 glasses to truly understand why people look. I just did a roundtable with Meltzer, Kurt, and Baldred on the show, and you heard Dave and Kurt both still gushing about Dynamite Kid versus Tiger Mask, and I know that's one of the matches on Jeff's top 100 of the 80s. So at the end of the 80s, that match still resonated with people. Does it hold up now? I don't like the term hold up, but again, you have to look at it in the context of the time. And I think for that reason, it's not only important, but good and highly influential. You have to look at Brody the same way. You have to look at Brody with those glasses from that time period. You know, again, go back to this fan who grew up on the WWF. If, you know, you've been watching these big heels just lumbering around for years, Brody was different. He did move more than the average heel. He did jump in the air more. He was more action than the average heel. Now, when you say he didn't draw in America, he didn't work for too many places. You know, when Buck Robley booked Georgia, he worked there. He worked for a little while in Florida. He never worked for Bill Watts again after having problems with him. He didn't work for too many people. He worked for Fritz. And it's hard to say whether during the boom he was much of a draw, but obviously they brought him in to be Kerry's partner, if you remember, for one of the Star Wars specials. And then he went in there and was the booker when World Class and Dallas was dying. So you really can't judge him on that. But St. Louis was the wrestling capital and Brody was a draw there. Brody was a major star there.
Exceptions to every rule, Brian. There's exceptions to every rule. I just want to get back to another point as well. You know, talking about 1983 eyes rather than 2017 eyes. That's like, in a way, saying you can't appreciate Shakespeare or understand Shakespeare unless you read him through 1590 eyes. You know,
I'm not saying that. But I'm saying if you utterly dismiss Shakespeare for that reason, you say, oh, it's complete garbage. I don't see how anyone would have liked it. And then you could say, well, people liked it at that time because compare it to these other people. It's different because it's hard to compare something hundreds of years old where we don't have too much of the contemporary competitive writers and playwrights. We don't have a lot of their material floating around. I'm not a big, you know, fan of plays or anything, or Shakespeare for that matter. But with Brody and Tiger Mask Dynamite Kid, we have every territory. We have every Japanese company. We have every territory in America and in Canada, for the most part, covered. We could see wrestling from all of those different places.
Agreed. But no. I can see it all from those. Right. The other thing as well, like you were saying before about, you know, him being a draw in St. Louis. Yeah, he was a draw in St. Louis. And I'm not saying that he's this person that shouldn't be considered as a kind of icon of the sport or anything, because he had a fantastic look, a fantastic presence, fantastic charisma. I just think that he's completely overstated. Dave Meltzer, in a way, has made him into a deity, you know, this complete figure. And I think some of that is because of his passing, unfortunately. And if he didn't pass in 88, his career would have wound down. And people talk about this as well, Brian. Oh, he may have ended up in ECW. Hey, right, Brody, when he died, what? How old was he? Was he 42 in 88?
I believe so, yeah.
So ECW comes around, it starts getting hot, 195, or more interest, obviously, 94, 95. So what, he's pushing his late 40s. Is he going to deal with Paul Heyman's shit? Is he going to deal with Paul Heyman's lies? Is he going to cope well in Turner? How's he going to deal in that sort of atmosphere? It's not going to last anywhere. I cannot see him doing much outside of Japan. Yeah, I think what would have been perfect for him would have been Anita, FMW. I think that would have been where Brody would have really excelled later on in his career. I don't think he would have really had any longevity at all in the US. Like Stan Hansen, in a way, his priority was always Japan. Even when he was in WCW in 1990, even when he was the US champion, it was never his priority. It was always his second booking. I think Brody would always get the bookings in Japan. He'd never have a long run, even, you know, in WWF. I don't think Vince would have offered him the money that Brody would have wanted to go in for at that stage of the game in Brody's career.
But if you just want to look at Japan, he's arguably the biggest gaijin of the 1980s. And you brought up a couple interesting points about his drawing ability compared to what came right after him. For instance, like Choshu going to All Japan when Brody goes to New Japan in 85.
Yeah.
With all due respect to Brody or any other gaijin, for the most part, I don't think it's fair to compare a great drawing gaijin or a big star versus the cream of the crop of Japanese wrestling. You know, Choshu was a big deal. Tenryu and Saruta, when that happened, was a big deal. And it is different than when you have an American wrestler versus a Japanese wrestler. The Choshu thing was huge. I mean, that was a hot deal at that time. Brody, now it is important to note, he goes to New Japan, and what is the first thing he does? He main events against Inoki at the brand new Sumo Hall. That's a big show. The first show at the Sumo Hall, the new Sumo Hall, they main event, sell it out.
I'm not doubting he was over in Japan. I just don't think, I think it's all comes down to how overstated he is as someone who is this, the brawler, the brawler. I mean, that might be more what I take Humbridge to than, you know, was he this figure? Because, you know, I'm not going to disagree that he isn't iconic, because he truly is. I think he's a cult figure. I don't think, you know, in the consensus of, like, you know, the culture, culturally, I don't think he transcends anything outside of wrestling at all. I think, you know, there's someone like Andre the Giant does a far better job than that. He was a touring guy as well. And here's a question for you, Brian. Do you think Brody would have coped well when All Japan shifted from the, and I think you discussed this actually, on the previous shows. Do you think, honestly, would have coped well from going more to the clean finishes that Baba introduced rather than the, you know, the count on DQ ones that they had throughout the 80s?
Dave Meltzer thought so, and Dave Meltzer knew him, and I didn't. So I'm going to go based on that, but I guess the bigger issue would be how long would he have lasted in Japan? He was getting older. His body was breaking down. Dave has said it, and I've heard other people discuss it. Brody would have been willing to do business with McMahon and Hogan to do a loop with Hogan, take the boot, and lose. Now, would they have trusted him? I don't know. But he would have been willing to do that. And then after that, who knows? Look, he would have had problems with Paul Heyman and with WCW, because people who had problems with bad management had problems with WCW and Heyman. Brody wouldn't have put up with Heyman's lies or Heyman, you know, being difficult to get on the phone with, I don't think. So I don't know.
I think
I don't know where is it, but here's the thing. I mean, let's go back to your initial hypothesis here. Your initial hypothesis was what? Bruiser Brody is overrated, or he's not as good as people make him out to be?
I think he's overrated as a worker. I think that's the major kind of crux of what I'm trying to say in a roundabout
way. No, but I agree with you somewhat with that. I will agree with you with that. I find that I don't enjoy Bruiser Brody matches as much now as I did in my head before I saw them. And the lack of selling is a part of it. I think you can have an argument there, but I think, not that you're trying to diminish his place in wrestling, but I think it somewhat does that when you attribute his legendary status simply to the fact that Dave did his first special edition of The Observer in 1988 after his friend passed away, who also happened to be, at that time, the biggest Gaijin star in Japan, major star in Puerto Rico, obviously, and someone who was a star everywhere he went. Now, there weren't as many places for him to go at that time, but I don't buy that he's just this, we think of him this way just because Dave did a special issue and named an award after him. I think if he had died and Dave just treated it the way he treated every other wrestling death. And by the way, beyond the fact that it was his friend that died, it's also a pretty scandalous story that it's the murder and everything. And I mean, that's a story that needs to be paid attention to. But I think if he had just died, if he had had a heart attack, we would still look back and say, wow, from 1980 to 1988, this guy was a major, major star. I mean, he was a big deal. He was a big, big deal.
Of course, I'm not going to disagree. I mean, I've watched the documentary on High Spots. I've got the Brody book that was... who wrote the Brody book? Was it Larry? I think it was Larry Madison.
I think it was Larry and maybe Brody's
and his wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've got that book as well. I read that a few years ago. I think Dave doesn't really back up his justifications as well as I would hope that whenever mentioned with Brody. I mean, Dave's go-to argument for Brody is, you know, every 6'4" to 6'9" guy being taught how to wrestle is told to view Brody tapes because he's a prototype for how the big guys work. You know, and this is the same Dave. He doesn't really back up why is it that that's how he should work. He's like, why is he a good worker, Dave? He never actually gives an actual breakdown of why he's great. And this is the same Dave Meltzer, if you remember, thought Hulk Hogan was a poor worker. He's a big man. And I know, you know, and this is Dave was watching the footage in the 80s. I can go back now and I'm looking through 2017 eyes and I can appreciate these Hogan house show matches he's having. And some of them are really, really good. And, you know, and this is the Dave at the time who was saying he was a bad worker. So how can I take everything he says as, well, not I'm saying you should do.
Well, yeah, I'm
what
not
people
saying
do
you
is
should.
Gospel.
Yeah, I'm
but not. What people do, that people do, and that's the problem. They'll watch one or two Brody matches, they'll be okay, and then they'll hear all this hype about Brody, and then they'll have it ingrained that Brody was great. He was just the brawler. And like going back to my original point, Brian, was he any better brawler than Jim Duggan?
Yes.
Okay. You think he was?
Well, was Jim Duggan a good brawler after Mid-South anywhere ever?
No. Okay, so no, he wasn't. Was he put in a position to be? That's cartoon
no,
world,
but,
though.
But you're looking at Jim Duggan from 1982 to 1987, or 1986, let's say. So you're looking at a four-year period there. Was Brody a better brawler during those 4 years, 82 to 86?
I don't know. You know, I'm really a big fan of Jim Duggan and his work in, you know, in Mid-South. So that
and
might
I
be me
too.
And my...
I'm not trying to diminish Jim Duggan's work. I'm a big fan of him in Mid-South. I think he's...
Dugan, sorry, Dugan.
Yeah, well, now I know you really are a fan of him in Mid-South, that you mispronounced his name the way Bill Watts did. But, you know, Brody, again, too, you didn't even talk about promos. Excellent promo. Excellent promo guy.
No, I'm not going to disagree with you. He was a good promo, and he was one of those guys that kind of came through the... Well, I can imagine I didn't watch him at the time, and that's maybe why I'm not as high on him as, you know, someone like Dave who lived through him and who was his friend. And I think
See, that's the thing right there. That's the thing right there, and I always try to be conscious of this. Imagine you're sitting at home, Alan, in America, somehow, this magical little experiment we're going to do here. You're in America, it's 1982, and you're going to watch TBS on your local cable system. And you're used to it. You're used to, you know, the different guys out there. Hey, Dusty Rhodes maybe here, or Austin Idol, or Bob Armstrong. And then Brody comes out. He was so unique and so different, not just in the promos, but in the ring. That in-ring brawl style that not many people... really did well. I mean, you know who did well? Jim Duggan did it well. Terry Gordy did it well. Buzz Sawyer did it well. But Brody was considered by a lot of the smart fans at that time the guy who did it better than anyone else. And he did have that luxury of being in Japan where he was able to work his style and really never lose. I mean, he lost, you know, very few times in Japan in the 1980s. But that's what I always try to be conscious of, looking at it with context in mind and saying to myself, if I was watching, you know, whatever wrestling promotion in whatever year, and this guy was there, would he stand out? Would he seem good? Would he seem different? Would his promo stand out? And with Brody, And by the way, for a big man, he's pretty agile too. He's jumping. I mean, he gave people that knee drop.
Good drop kick.
Oh, yeah. And that knee drop. I mean, just he did stuff that a lot of big guys didn't do in an era before we saw big guys do any of that shit. I mean, who were the really big, agile big guys before Brody? Don Leo, Jonathan. Ernie Ladd wasn't really agile, and I wouldn't really call him a brawler. You know, who were the really, really big guys?
Yeah, not Ox
who
Baker.
Could do a lot. No, not Ox Baker. But see, that's the thing. If you grew up watching Ox Baker, and all of a sudden there's Brody, you could see why it would make an impact. It's a little different looking at it now. We've had guys who look like Brody. We've had guys with Brody in their name. We've had guys bigger than Brody do things off the top rope, do things to the floor. So it's easy to look at it now and say, oh, he's just another big bearded guy and he doesn't sell anything. But I think if you were watching at that time, he was really special.
Yeah. I just think he's overrated to the point that he's been put on this pedestal as the greatest brawler of all time, when I just don't rate him fully as this great brawler. I think there's so many people that are, you know, the same as him. But, you know, we could split hairs on this, you know, the rest, you know, all day. But I just think that that's my kind of take on it. And, you know, we can say, you know, just the final thing is, we can say someone's good and we can keep preaching it. We can preaching it. I implore people, go back and watch some of the footage. And that is, yeah, that's through 2017 eyes. I get that. But I just still think he's held on a pedestal even through 2017 eyes. And I think he's not as great as people like to think he is. He's an icon. He's an originator. He caught, you know, a path through wrestling that, you know, was, you know, someone who didn't take any bullshit and is a, you know, a truly independent contractor. But I just think he's just a little bit high up on a pedestal for me.
On the topic of the Best Brawler Award, the Observer Awards, which is obviously the Bruiser Brody Memorial Best Brawler Award, what are your opinions on the other awards Dave has named after people? The Bryan Danielson Best Technical Wrestler Award or the Ric Flair Luthez Wrestler of the Year Award?
Well, I guess it just points to how many years someone's won an award. And I think it gets a point, but that people are going to win an award year after year. Well, there's a danger because of Dave's influence that sometimes the Observer, and this may come into more a point for the Hall of Fame, it's more of a hive mind. What Dave says happens eventually because he pushes it, because he's got that sphere of influence. And, you know, to offset that, what Dave doesn't say or what he kind of makes negative about certain people is again going to influence votes. And I think, you know, Dave will put people over in the newsletter stronger than other people because that's his opinion and he's got every right to. But that is always going to influence people. So, and then they're going to in turn vote for those people. So I've got no problem with either Daniel Bryan or Ric Flair, Luthez, as much as I do with Brody. And maybe I'm more fans of them and their style and just recognizing Luthez as what an important historical figure he was and how he was the perennial NWA champion at a time where the NWA was pro wrestling in the, you know, in the US and in Canada and elsewhere. So, you know, I have no problem there. I think just Brody, maybe just I'm not a fan of his as much, and that's where this all might come from.
Before we go, I do have to ask you, obviously, one of the issues you bring up is the idea that the acclaim that Brody receives is, to some people, largely due to Dave Meltzer having him on a pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be bothered by this influence that you allege Dave Meltzer has if he put it behind, let's say, Big Daddy as a Hall of Fame candidate?
Well,
I see.
Now you said that, well, I don't know. I'm at a point now. No, I am at a point now where I try and look at things as objectionably as I can. Now that, you know, I've been given a Hall of Fame vote as well, so I try and look at things through fair eyes. And, you know, you can only do that so far. You live through certain things, you live through eras, so you're going to be more swayed to them unless something really resonates with you, like such as Sputnik Monroe and the whole how he changed things culturally in, you know, in the South, and, you know, the blacks and whites, you know, with segregation and being able to sit together is huge in Memphis and Tennessee and elsewhere. So that's really important for me, you know, getting someone like that recognized. But, you know, if he went and turned, you know, on a sixpence and went for Big Daddy, I'd just, you know, I'd see through it, obviously. But if he did it from the get-go, it'd be tough to say, really. I think, you know, because I am so strong again, you know, for Daddy, I probably wouldn't object as strongly as I am for, you know, how he is for Bruiser Brody. So I think that's a fair point there, Brian. I'll be fair with that one.
Well, I can't end it on a fair point. Any closing words you have to rile people up this week?
Well, let me just try and think of something to rile people up this week. Just in general, let's just think of some other guys that I just didn't think were great workers. Jake Roberts, there we go. We'll just start with Jake Roberts. Not a huge fan of Jake Roberts. I can't really think of a standout Jake Roberts match that he had from 1987 up until the end of his career that was, you know, this amazing match. So there we go. Jake Roberts is the guy that I might sacrifice on a future episode, Brian.
There you hear it, the somewhat controversial Alan Blackstock with his thoughts on Bruiser Brody. John, you know, since it's come up, what are your thoughts about Bruiser Brody's legacy and how we should look at him as an in-ring worker and what he did in the business beyond his tragic end?
there was definitely a time where Bruiser Brody may have been a bit overrated, especially like even before he died. I mean, the Observer fandom was crazy about him. Then when he was tragically murdered in 1988, of course, you get that sympathy and that looking back and, you know, oh my God, look how great he was. That lasted, I want to say, about 10 or 15 years after his death. Then I'm going to say right around 2002, 2003, that kind of turned around a little bit. People started calling Bruiser Brody overrated, and at that time he may have been. I feel like Bruiser Brody, though, for the last 10 or 15 years, has been called overrated so much that he's actually become underrated. He's the Pete Rose of professional wrestling.
Well, one of the things I said to Alan was, it's hard to judge Bruiser Brody today when you have all of these guys who are big, who can fly, who can come off the top rope, who could take big bumps. And there wasn't that. You know, how many guys, John, in the late 70s, early 80s were 6'4", 6'5", 300 pounds, and could do a dropkick like Bruiser Brody, or, you know, would move as much as Bruiser Brody?
I cannot think of a single one. I mean, who were their true giants of pro wrestling back then? You had Ernie Ladd, who was, you know, his knee problems had pretty much finished him up as a top performer. You had Big John Studd, forget about it. You had Blackjack Mulligan, forget about it twice. You know, Brody really stood out as just a phenomenal guy for his size. I mean, and if you look at what he did, he sold out Madison Square Garden twice against Bruno Sammartino. He had a big run in the WWF. He always was on the top of the card when he was in world class.
Everywhere he went. I mean, you know, unfortunately there were years, you know, there were times where he was in Kansas City or something, but St. Louis, Dallas, Houston, Atlanta, Japan, everywhere he went just about, he was a major attraction.
He had this weird month-long run in Florida where he was kind of Big John Studd's he was like the Robin to Big John Studd's Batman, which makes no sense.
Yeah.
But that was like, you know, it was a month, and he was probably writing off a Florida vacation for his family. But other than that, another thing about Brody, people forget what a great interview he was. Anytime he was on Atlanta TV or Dallas TV, he was great.
He was a fantastic interview, and that's one of the things that made him stand out. He wasn't just a guy who was going to stand at a microphone and say, I'm going to do this, this, and this. He was creative. He was one of those guys, I guess if he was walking to do an interview and he saw a mop or a garbage can, he would pick it up, he would carry it with him, and he would utilize it.
He almost made my list of potential NWA champions. The reason he didn't make the list is because he came across as just so much of a monster that, you know, if you put out, let's say, Mike Graham or Steve Kern, who might have been able to whip Bruiser Brody in a real fight, but as wrestling was presented, you know, if you have Mike Graham against Bruiser Brody, you don't think Mike Graham's going to win the NWA title.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I wouldn't put Brody on that list either. But there we go. Different points of view on Bruiser Brody, the late, great Bruiser Brody from Alan Blackstock, and of course, our very own John McAdam. And John, with that, it's time to move on to one of the most popular segments we've ever done on this show, What If?, where myself and David Bixenspan look at scenarios that the listeners send into facebook.com/superpodcast and say, what if? What could have happened? How, if things were done a little differently, would the entire history of wrestling have changed? Well, we'll find out what was sent in this week and what me and Bix have to say. Let's go to What If? Right now. It's time for another of one of our most popular segments here on the show, What If? And of course, that means I am joined by your friend and mine, David Bixenspan, Denim David Bixenspan. Bix, how's it going today?
Okay, I guess.
It's not my turn!
Thank you.
It's been a while since you heard that, but we have a lot of really interesting what-ifs today, and there's actually a few that I picked out specifically because I wanted to hear what you had to say, and let's get going, and let's start with the first one here. It's from Brian Huff. What if Gino Hernandez doesn't pass away? Does he go on to the WWF or maybe WCW? I know that you, or someone who appreciates Gino, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, when the NWA On Demand service was active and all that Houston footage went up, you really got to see more of Gino and evaluate him even more. So what do you think? I mean, let's, if Gino doesn't pass away, let's just make this a complete hypothetical. What if Gino doesn't have a drug problem altogether? So you're getting the best of Gino. What happens? What happens after World Class?
The thing is, though, is he is kind of a homebody and likes sticking around Texas regardless. Like, did he have any real run of note outside of Texas in one territory or the other?
No.
Other than Detroit. Going to all Japan.
Detroit.
Was he full-time there or was he just flying in?
I couldn't tell you that, but they made him U.S. champion in Detroit pretty early on, didn't they?
I think. I don't know if he was full-time, but that's also when he's younger and less able to call his own shots.
Right, and when he was younger, they were kind of setting Gino up for something. I mean, Bosch was. I mean, he was like one of the youngest guys to work in MSG, to work in Japan. He was going to Detroit. He got a monster push in Houston as a babyface and a heel. But like you said, you know, I mean, for the most part, he was working for Joe Blanchard, or he worked for Fritz, or he worked for Paul Bosch. He did work for Watts, too, but it was really Texas for him. One of the questions about him going to the WWF would have to naturally be his physique.
Yeah. I mean, he looked like an athlete, but he didn't look like a WWF superstar.
I mean, it's hard to say, what if he doesn't pass away? Where does he go? He would have fit into mid to late 80s Crockett Promotions a lot better than the WWF. Like, he would have been good in like the Million Dollar Man type role if he had a little bit of a better physique, I think, because you couldn't work with Hogan with it. Well, I don't know. I mean, because the thing was, Gino was good at getting heat. Gino was like a real, like, he would piss you off and get heat. So maybe because of that, his physique wouldn't be as much of a problem, because he wouldn't be able to cleanly beat Hogan. He would have to cheat and fool around with him. And again, I'm putting in there with Hogan. I don't know if that would be the guy he would be working with necessarily. But just...
No. You put him in with Tito for the IC title, and he does promos about how he's not a dirty Mexican.
How he's the handsome half-breed.
Exactly. That's what it would be, I think. And I think that could be interesting.
Look, I think that may have been more interesting than anything Tito did. I'll say that. After the Savage feud, unless you're a big Strikeforce fan, I don't know.
I really like the Strikeforce Islanders matches.
Yeah, those are really good. Those are really good.
Especially that one in Boston.
What did you think? You ever see that match? It's from the AWA, maybe 82, 81.
High Flyers versus Strikeforce?
Yeah.
They have a couple matches together.
They do, but how many are on tape? Is the San Francisco one on film, or is it the one from Minnesota?
I think they're both from St. Paul.
Okay, I mean, that's one of those matches I was actually saying to Jeff Bowden recently. If you were going to redo the top 100 matches of the 80s, that's one. If you were going to add to it, that may be one to look at.
Yeah, well, all of that AWA house show stuff wasn't around then, I don't think. I think that all came along more recently in terms of being available on video.
Yeah, I don't know when it was around, but I never saw it until recently. So I can only base it on that. But, all right, well, we kind of answered what if Gino doesn't pass away. Let's move on to another one here, Bix. Paul Skivers, it could be Skivers, but I think it's Skivers.
Let's go with Skivers just in case.
Paul Skivers asks, what if Antonio Inoki had a lone run as WWF champion? He kind of did. But what do you think of Inoki as a champion at some point, Bix?
Is he just doing the Baba thing like he kind of did, or would this be to actually go to the Garden and defend the belt?
He did the Baba thing just without telling anyone.
Well, no. The title win was as planned. It was then after the match where it's supposed to be returned or whatever it was, where then Shinma's his guy, but Shinma's also the kayfabe WWF president, he ruled the title was still with Inoki. That was the double cross.
Right, which led to, what was it, Backlund versus Greg Valentine for the held up
title? No, Bobby Duncan.
Was it Bobby Duncan?
Yes.
So Backlund versus Bobby Duncan for the held up WWF, or it was actually, I don't think.
It's December 79, so it's WWF.
Yeah. I was about to say that. So yeah, so there you go. I mean, after that point, I don't know where Inoki would have had that run. If what if you had Inoki replace the Iron Sheik as that transition between Backlund and Hogan? It wouldn't have worked. Inoki wouldn't have done it too, and it wouldn't have worked. So I don't know where else he would have gotten a WWF title run. Bix, the next one is from Calvin Cotton. What if Continental got on ESPN in the mid-80s instead of the AWA? I have heard they were in the running for a while when ESPN was looking to add wrestling to their schedule.
Why don't we just do this for everyone that was in the running, I guess? Or that did try to get the slot that we know of.
Mid-South.
Memphis in conjunction with All-South. Continental, of course, because that's where the Continental rebranding and the different type of TV tapings came from Fuller trying to get the ESPN deal. I think World Class was in the running. I don't know if they were asked or whatever. I think they were in contention at that moment. I think those are the ones.
I think pretty, I mean, other than Crockett, And I just don't know. I haven't heard that. But I think just about everyone was trying to get that spot. Everyone saw what it was. Everyone saw Cable was the game.
Yes.
And, you know, the AWA got it because of Sergeant Slaughter. Well, I shouldn't say it was because of Sergeant Slaughter.
No, it was because of Sergeant Slaughter.
Was it? Because, I mean, the story in the ESPN oral history was that they were running through the names they had. And when they said Sergeant Slaughter, one of the executives said, oh, my God, they got Slaughter. But it wasn't like it was recognized as, oh, he knows who this guy is. We should do this deal with the AWA. It was more like everyone in the room stopped and looked at him like, I can't believe you watch wrestling.
Yeah, but wasn't that story around in some form before the ESPN book, too, that they went with AWA because of Slaughter?
Maybe, but I mean, I don't know where that story came from.
At that point in time, yeah, it's 85, so they're still in solid shape. But the only reason that you would really want to go for them other than Slaughter is that they're a major market company.
Well, let's go back to the premise of this question, Bix. What if Continental had got that ESPN spot?
That's an interesting question. In part because no one really got big off of ESPN. World Class did end up on there eventually, but it was after the peak, and they got big from syndication. So based on what did happen, it's hard to say because you can't say, well, this is what happened, and then this is what could have happened with this other promotion.
No, but you bring up an interesting point that you could look at the wrestling on TBS, you could look at the wrestling that was on WOR, you could look at the wrestling that was on USA, and all of that TV helped those promotions. ESPN is this unique entity that didn't help any of the promotions that were ever on it. Like, well, no one really benefited greatly from being on ESPN.
The AWA did, but just only because of the kept money. Them in business.
Yeah, yes. Just because of the money. Yes. But it wasn't like, it didn't it propel gave them a business. Boost. No. Yeah, it didn't do anything to propel their business. It just gave them money for TV, which not everyone was getting back then. Memphis was getting money for TV still at that point, but not everyone was.
That said, Continental is a company putting on really good TV with good talent in good-sized buildings. They have Gordon Solie.
Right.
It definitely changes things for that territory and for a lot of those wrestlers.
In terms of the way we look at them, sure. Like if you look at someone like Brad Armstrong, and it's funny too, because I mean, you know, Brad Armstrong in many ways is a central figure in Watts' attempt to get the TBS deal. You know, I hadn't thought of it that way, but Brad Armstrong's a guy, if things had worked out just a little bit differently, we would look at Brad Armstrong like a major star today.
Yes, and also just the perception of that territory. I think that's the biggest thing. Even if it doesn't really propel them business-wise, although it does give them extra money to work with, in a territory that had pretty solid payoffs, all things considered, relative to the crowd sizes and everything, probably changes the economics a little in that territory, and maybe lets them carry on longer, you know, after it's sold to David Woods. But I think the biggest thing is that it's not this, I don't want to say lost territory because we have the footage, but it's really something that didn't get covered at all.
And it wasn't talked about in tape trading circles at all in the 90s, at least amongst the people I was trading with. And I think Continental is like up there with Memphis, not at the level of Memphis, but right below it in terms of promotions that people have been able to properly evaluate or reevaluate
from YouTube
for the first
and
time
stuff.
Because of YouTube. Yeah, because I got to admit, I've seen more Continental in the last few years because of YouTube than I ever saw as a tape trader. Because even if I wanted it, I didn't know people that had really good quality Continental. I got some stuff through the Steve Minari collection that was like really good quality at that time, like the Austin Idol Ric Flair stuff, the Ron Fuller Ric Flair stuff, and that was really good. And that actually wasn't Continental yet. That was still Southeastern.
That was like late Southeastern, late 84, early 85, right?
Maybe even a little bit before. And I think it may have been 83 Flair Idol. I could be wrong.
Okay.
I could be wrong. But I never saw Continental like on tape trading lists or anything. And again, whoa, you know, I think if it was on cable, you know, that roster, it changes the way you see a Robert Fuller, a Tom Pritchard, a Brad Armstrong, that entire crew. When you hear people talk about Kevin Sullivan, it's, you know, Florida and then Crockett. People forget, you know, Continental. You know, he was
and
there.
And Knoxville before that as a babyface.
Yeah.
And you watch that stuff on YouTube. It really is a tremendous show. And with what you're saying about tape traders, too, it was on in Atlanta for most of its run as part of the Pedicino block.
Yeah, now that you say that, that's really the only place where you would see footage when you were trading tapes. At least for me, again, everyone was different.
Was Pro Wrestling This Week.
When you would see a compilation of Pedicino's show, yeah.
But they showed the actual the whole weekly Continental Wrestling show aired on the Pedestino block. It might have actually been on even before the Superstars of Wrestling block, like Memphis was, because Memphis, I think, started in 84 in Atlanta.
It's weird. I've been looking a lot at some of the weird distributions, like, you know, when Memphis all of a sudden in 84 ends up airing in Miami. You know, like, that's like a really interesting one. And, you know,
that's understandable, though, because Lawler was over in Florida.
He wasn't that over.
He was over enough to bring over the Funk program.
He wasn't over enough to bring over his television show.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how that deal happened. But the other one is when going through some 1982 Bill Watts stuff, right when they made the deal, right when they took over Oklahoma and Arkansas from Leroy McGurk and became the full-fledged Mid-South territory, they're announcing, like, we want to welcome the new people on TV watching in Oklahoma and Arkansas. And then they say, and we want to say hello to everyone watching in Southern California and San Diego and Los Angeles on the Spanish channel. So I didn't know that. I didn't know Watts was in California in 1981, 1982.
Well, do we know if they're not just making that up to make the show look bigger?
Why would Mid-South Wrestling make up two towns and both of them are Los Angeles and San Diego?
I guess that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to make up something like that, hey, we're in New York, we're in Chicago, we're in Atlanta, we're everywhere. Not, we also have these two towns on the West Coast that we're in.
Why was ICW, the Papo's ICW, airing in Northern California? The way Meltzer was able to see so much of it.
Well, that's a little different because that all goes down with the post-Shire stuff because, like, for a little while there, Florida got on TV in San Francisco.
No. But Shire was running off of the Florida TV.
And then ICW aired after Shire was done or was shot. No, Shire tried to use them, didn't he?
Not ICW, I don't think. Shire tried to use Portland, Kansas City, and Florida.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the Amarillo TV was Terry Garvin trying to run the towns that Shire came up. Gave up.
By the way, great idea to try to use the Kansas City TV in another market. But
it's weird, isn't it?
That's something I'd like to look into for a future segment. It's just some of the interesting distributions. You know, John Hitchcock was on here talking about getting Florida TV in the early 70s in Greensboro. On, you know, early cable television. Just when did shows start getting distributed outside of the territory? That's something, you know, that's something we should look into for a future show. That's a good topic. But yes. I think we answered the Continental one, and yeah, I think you and I are both in agreement that it is probably the most underrated territory of, you know, the last 20 years of the territories, because not enough people talk about Southeastern and Continental. But Bix, two people here sent in the same question. This one I was saving for you. John McAdam and I talk about it a little bit earlier in the show as a hypothetical. But I'll read you both questions and then have you give your thoughts. Dallas Goff wants to know about Lawler as an NWA champion. And then Laszlo Takacs, I hope I'm pronouncing that last name correctly.
That name is awesome.
It's an amazing name. I just hope I'm doing it justice. Laszlo Takacs. I love that. His last name sounds like the sound that the monsters made in Mars Attacks. But anyway, Laszlo Takacs says, what if Jerry Jarrett convinced the NWA to give Lawler the NWA title in the 70s? And that's the question. Like I said, we talked about it a little earlier in the show, but what do you think, Bix, as in the 70s, let's look at when Lawler realistically could have gotten it. Would have been Briscoe or Terry Funk or Harley Race. Those are the three champions, you know, not counting Baba or Dusty. Those are the three champions for the next several years. What do you think of the idea of Lawler having a run with the NWA title at that time in the 70s?
The tricky part is they hadn't really built up his name yet. Or are we building in the assumption that they had gotten him to travel around to build up his name?
If you want to, I mean, you know, what if Jerry Jarrett convinced the NWA to give him the title? That means that would have probably had to have happened.
I think that's fair to assume then.
Yeah.
Well, so when in the 70s are we talking?
Well, like I said, it would have to be at some point from 74 on. So let's be realistic about it. Let's say 76, 77, somewhere in there.
So still close enough to the big bumping high spot Lawler for him to be able to do that style in other territories.
Yes, but I don't know how that style would have worked in the main event in St. Louis. That's the first thing I'm thinking of as the NWA champion.
True. It's hard to say because Lawler really could do a lot, but he only saved it for certain opponents. Like, you watch him with Bockwinkle. I think Bockwinkle's best matches that are on video might be with Lawler.
I think you're right.
I'm a big Bockwinkle
fan.
Certainly
the most heated matches are with Lawler.
Yeah, those guys were made to wrestle each other, in a sense. They're perfect foils for each other. Like, in terms of guys who work clashing styles, I think that might be one of my favorite pairings.
Yeah, I don't know if Lawler at that time, physique-wise, would have worked everywhere. Also, people didn't know him yet. I don't know. And, of course, this led to Jerry Jarrett forming a relationship with Vern Gagne, thinking he'll at least be able to get the AWA title on Jerry Lawler. But that took a long time to happen, too. I don't know. I personally don't really see it happening at that point.
Yeah. Having said that, in 85, when it had been promised to him, I think that could have worked at least short term.
In 85, I think you look at possible NWA champions. Let's not look at world class. Let's not include Kerry gets it again or anything. You look at Lawler. You look at DiBiase, guys that could have done good in that role. If you want to go under the assumption they would have been able to work Memphis, Mid-South, Crockett, or, you know, some sort of group like that. I mean, at this point, the NWA is dying. I know, you know, we talked about Continental. I think Continental or Southeastern at that point. Ron Fuller, I think that's when he was the vice president of the NWA. So, I mean, they were still in there. But, you know, just like Continental is overlooked, people forget that the NWA had affiliation, you know, with that office for a long time.
I don't think it works in the 70s. I think in 85, he's been on TBS a few times by then. You know, he can talk. He's something different.
If you read the magazines, you know who he is.
Yeah, I think that would have worked. I think that I don't know if you could have had much of a shelf life, especially with where everything was trending with Crockett. But I think you give him a couple months, enough to not make it just feel like he's getting it as a token thing. I think it works. Enough to where he's comparable to Dusty, where in the grand scheme of things, Dusty feels like more of a real former champion than Kerry or Tommy Rich or Bob. You know what I mean?
Well, he made sure to celebrate more than everyone else did. that may be part of it. But, you know, with Lawler, he would have been the best possible example of a guy who can work babyface at home and be the ultimate heel touring champion, too.
He did it plenty of times.
I mean, you know, look at the Piper stuff, where he's the babyface in Memphis and he's the heel in Atlanta. And it was just, it's great stuff. So, but that's that. But let's talk a little bit about Dusty Rhodes. Jay McDougald. I think I'm pronouncing that correct.
McDougal with a D at the end?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why I'm a little confused.
The past tense of McDougal?
Yes, he's the past tense of McDougal.
So McDougal, E.D. Okay.
Yes. Jay McDougal says, what if Dusty Rhodes stayed in Florida instead of going to JCP? That's a fascinating one. I mean, nothing could have saved Florida, I don't think, at that time. But what do you think?
It does seem like a lot of what sped up the decline was Dusty leaving, though.
Yeah, I think that's part of it.
And it's one of the last real cases of a guy leaving a promotion as Booker and taking his crew with him, too.
Yeah, that's true, too. And we also don't know how different things would have been if Eddie Graham still commits suicide in early 85 and Dusty's there instead of in Crockett. You know, what happens in the office at that point? You know, where Mike Graham and Dusty, would everything be cool? Or Dusty say, I'm the top star? You know, I'm just assuming things. I don't know for sure. I'm just guessing about this. But, you know, the other interesting thing to look at it the other way, what if Dusty Rhodes had stayed in Florida? Who's booking for Mid-Atlantic in 84?
Better not keep being Dory.
No, well, better not be keep being Dory. It's not going to be Ernie Ladd or Gary Hart, probably. I hope it wouldn't be Ole, you know, at that point. But you have to wonder if Dusty's not there, the trajectory of Jim Crockett Promotions, the talent that came in, the aggressive expansion, how much of that would have not happened without Dusty there? And then again, who's in that place? You're still at war with Vince. Nothing was going to prevent that. Who would have been someone who could have booked Mid-Atlantic in 1984, 1985? So on. I don't know. Who do you think? Who was available that you think would have been good in that role?
Okay, so who's okay? So we're talking 84. So Dory leaves. I mean, I could see a scenario where the Ladd Wahoo Hart trio takes over as co-bookers at first, but I agree that wouldn't be the long-term scenario.
Right.
Okay, so who is available that's been booking territories, especially major territories?
Dundee's in Mid-South. Memphis has their own in-house bookers. Kevin Sullivan is in Florida, but I don't think he would have been the guy at that time. And he had actually just been there with Gary Hart managing him and Mark Lewin.
And had Kevin really booked anywhere yet?
Kevin, by that point, you know, he had come up with a lot of his own ideas, but
I don't think he had booked a territory yet.
No, Bob Roop had been a booker, I think.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly. Who else would have been? Buck Robley would have been available. I don't see that as being a fit. Frankie Kane was available. I don't think that would have happened at that time.
No.
Obviously, there are guys who potentially could have, like, you know, Ric Flair at various times tried to book. So he's someone who potentially could say after Starrcade, hey, I'm the champion. And I could see this scenario, you know, I want to be the booker too, and giving it a try there. It's not going to be Tully. George Scott's working for Vince.
I'm almost half, I'm mostly joking when I say this. I shouldn't say almost half joking. Sam Menaker's around.
Well, come on, give me a break. What do you say? He'll give Paul Jones and Johnny Weaver a chance to book before he gives Sam Menaker a chance to book.
Shire's out of the business.
Shire's out of the business. If, you know, Dusty stays in Florida, you can't put Eddie Graham into the equation at all. It's an interesting thing. You know, everyone says, oh, yeah, what happened to Florida? But what would have happened to JCP if he had not come to?
I was going to say, but Piper's not there.
No.
Like, if Piper hadn't left, I would say Piper.
Piper is the booker?
He ended up doing a hell of a job in Portland years later.
Yeah.
It's a different type of thing, creativity-wise, at least.
Different thing. He's also in a different place in his life in Portland than he was in 1984. So I don't see it as a really good fit at that time. You know, I hate to say it, but if things still went down with Vince in Georgia, you may see Ole having a stronger relationship with the Crockett office than he had, where he actually did have some power after everything went down.
Yeah, I guess Ole. I don't really see who else it could be.
You're not getting Watts? I mean, there aren't too many options out there.
Actually, okay, so of the three other bookers that are there at the time, if Dory's gone, if one was going to take the reins, I guess it would be Wahoo.
Because of the relationship with the promotion? Cause obviously
Gary, and the history and the territory, yeah.
Well, because who had the most booking experience? Would it have been Gary Hart or would it have been Ernie Ladd?
I think it would be Gary, then Wahoo, then Ernie. As far as officially being the booker.
An interesting scenario there. This next one's really interesting too, Bix. Let's go to Japan for this one. From Mike Campbell. What if the Dynamite Kid decided to accept Tsuyama's invitation and jump to the UWF rather than All Japan? Would Davey Boy have gone with him? When the WWF comes calling, does he leave the UWF for them or wait until after the UWF shuts? Interesting scenario there.
Well, also when he would have first been going to the UWF was working with the WWF.
Because of Tsuyama? Well, no, because of
Shinma.
Shinma, yeah.
Very briefly, they're working with the WWF. At the March 84 Garden Show, when Maeda beats Pierre Lefebvre for the international title or whatever it's called, it's like the belt, I believe, says Universal Wrestling Federation on it.
But Vince still has the booking arrangement with New Japan for another 2 years.
That whole period's very complicated, because especially if you read the newsletters at the time, that like New Japan is actually brokering who can go. There are some people that they're actually kind of peacefully sending over. Like, it's not, if you go by those and take them at face value, that split was a lot more amicable than people remember, I think, at least according to those newsletters at the time. How much of that is true, I don't really know. So I don't know if it changes that much, because he ends up not being in All Japan for that long anyway. I guess the bigger, really in the grand scheme of things, the bigger question is if he ends up in All Japan after he leaves the WWF.
Well, he did end up in All Japan after he left the WWF.
No, I'm saying if he never goes to All Japan the first time.
Oh, what? Jeez, that's interesting.
Or does he go to New Japan?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's weird. Dynamite, do you think he would have been a good fit in that original UWF?
Well, you have to remember, when he's initially getting the invite, it's probably before they've converted over to Shoot style.
Right. You're probably right about that.
People forget those first couple tours, at least. It's just another promotion doing New Japan style.
Right. And then Maeda got more influence going forward and, you know, Tsuyama also checked out. So it's interesting. It's an interesting scenario. What would have happened there? Let's get a couple more here, Bix.
Oh, wait. Actually, if it's to go instead of All Japan, I'd like to know what the actual timeline is. If it's instead of All Japan, when he's going to All Japan, then it's the end of the year and they are a shoot style promotion.
Okay. Well, I hope that answered your question. A couple more here, Bix. Jeff Luxon says, what if Billy Jack Haynes was not also his worst enemy? I feel in the 80s he looked like a world champion. Also, what if USWA heel Billy Jack showed up to feud with Bret Hart in the WWF? Heel Billy Jack in the USWA was insane. That guy would have been money anywhere. I just don't know how you could have relied on him. That would have been an issue. But Billy Jack Haynes in 1995 in the USWA is one of the best heels in wrestling that year. He was phenomenal. Going to the question of what if he wasn't his own worst enemy? I don't know. The sky in many ways was the limit.
He really just kills his career. I mean, even before he ends up having the longer WWF run, he just leaves so many places so quickly in 84, 85.
No, by the time he gets to the WWF for that second run, the real run in 86, it's over. Because he had walked out of Mid-Atlantic, Florida, World Class.
WWF.
WWF the first time, and they were ready to push him to the moon. They already did that cartoon of him and Hulk Hogan and Wendy Richter on the sled, you know, for the winter issue of the program. And Billy Jack, from a few years of being on those magazine covers, went from a guy that you thought was going to dominate in the 80s alongside Kerry and Tony Atlas and everyone else that was on those covers to a guy that, from 86 on, noticed the role that the WWF kept him in. It was kind of middle-of-the-road babyface on the shows.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, from what we've seen later, I mean, when you say he wasn't his worst enemy, he's clearly a guy who's had long-term issues with mental illness in some form. I don't think it's unfair to say that. So
no,
it's a different time. I think if Billy Jack Haynes came along now, he'd probably have those issues in check because he'd be seeing a doctor.
Well, Bix, our next one here, Tony Barker. What if Tully Blanchard does return to WCW in 93 and reform the Horsemen with Flair, Arn, and Ole?
Why are we just talking about 93? Why aren't we talking about every time Tully Blanchard almost came back?
Right. Well, specifically 93, it would have been weird because he would have been brought back. Well, I guess actually, I was about to say he would have been brought back as a babyface, but he would have been brought back as a babyface in 89, I guess. I mean, if we assume that the way Ole was used was the way Tully would have been used when Arn returned, then he would have been brought back as a babyface there too.
Mm-hmm.
If he came in 93, I don't know. He would have been brought in as a babyface on the set of a Flair for the Gold. I think Roma gets unfairly maligned. He shouldn't have been in that role, but Roma's actually really good, I think.
Yeah.
But Ole wasn't going to wrestle, so you still need a fourth horseman. I don't know if it would still be Roma, but if you have Tully, Arn, and Flair, Tully hadn't worked full-time in a long time, you would still need another guy. And again, you have babyface Tully Blanchard. No one wants to see that.
No. And also, in 93, really the weirdest thing to me about that one, he's in the building at Slamboree when they do that and bring out Roma as the fourth horseman.
And that's the second time that happened. Was it the Texas Clash of Champions in 1990 where Sting got hurt? Was that the event that Tully was there with his lawyer?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. And then also Tully had been kicked out of the CNN Center with his lawyer by Jim Herd, right?
Yeah. The way he's treated over that whole period is extremely strange. I'm sure some of it had to do with however he was handling it, but so much of it wasn't. So in 93, well, also one of the weird parts about 93 is that really for pretty much the whole time, there were only three horsemen. Because Ole is theoretically the fourth horseman, but he's only there at Slamboree, and that's it.
The other thing is with Tully, at that time, did WWF tend to, I mean, when there was a drug test failure, they didn't make it public like that, did they?
No, I've wondered about that. Were they actively trying to sabotage him?
That's what I wonder. Like when Jake failed his drug test that summer in 89, right? Isn't that when Jake went away to rehab for a while when DiBiase stuffed the money down his throat?
If the DiBiase program is one of the rehab stints or drug test failures, yes, it would be 89.
Yeah, I mean, did they ever publicly announce those? I mean, the Tully thing.
No.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes it so odd. It was almost like it was done to spite Tully.
None of the drug tests were. So it's just unfortunate, too. Like, why? And why only why Tully of all people would you do that to? Because he wanted to leave after only a year? You already took the belts off of him.
It's such a weird scenario. Everything that went down with Tully after November of 89 is just all so weird. Everything with Jim Herd, but then after Jim Herd, stuff was still going on. and just the way he was treated coming out of the WWF. I don't know. I don't know what the hell all that is.
Yeah.
But,
so yeah, 93, I think he ends up being a bad fit as a babyface and leaving before long.
Yeah.
In 90, I think he performs better, at least because he would get turned heel so quickly.
Right, and then potentially you have 90, it could have been Arn, Flair, Tully, and Wyndham, because Wyndham returns to the Horsemen.
Right, I don't think they put Sid in the Horsemen if Tully's there. And then what happens with Sid, especially because Sid in late 90 and early 91 has that weird period where he'll disappear for part of the time, or he'll be completely disconnected from the Horsemen. He'll reform the Skyscrapers as babyfaces. He'll team with Stan Hansen. He's in the Horsemen, but he's not really with the Horsemen. So were there other plans they had for him?
What am I forgetting? He reformed the Skyscraper as babyfaces. When was that?
Starrcade 90. Him and Spivey against the Big Cat and Motor City Madness.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yes, I forgot about that. Is that the same night that Wyndham and Arn went against Doom?
In the street fight, yes.
Yeah, okay. That's right. I forgot about that. That is weird. That is weird. Well, there's a lot of weirdness in 1990 WCW, but we won't.
Yes,
that.
But yeah, it is a bit strange. The two of the biggest pops on that show are Chris Adams, who doesn't work for the promotion, and heel Sid, excuse me, who's in the top heel group, reuniting his old tag team as baby faces.
Crazy. Well, Bix, one last one here this week. It's from Jamie Hama. What if Terry and Dory Funk went to World Class in 85 to feud with the Von Erichs? That would have been it. Or just Terry would have been interesting. I mean, you know, obviously they're together. I don't mean to put it that way, but Terry's promos would have just been crazy.
Yeah.
It would have been a different look because they would have been older than everyone that was working with the Von Erichs. I don't know. I don't know how that would have worked.
He probably would have called them horse-faced.
It would have worked in a sense at that time, too, that Fritz had the relationship with All Japan, so that would have played into it.
Yes, although that changes not long after
that. Not long after that, no.
That would probably be the end of that.
It's so crazy. Just all the moves with all the Japanese companies in the 80s, it's so crazy.
Which is a thing that got some bad attention towards the wrestling business, because that's not how business was done in Japan. In Japan, you work somewhere forever. You didn't just leave.
Yeah, you don't walk off a train when you're going to do the job in the tag tournament.
Right. Well, both with the natives and the foreigners, more so the natives, though, that it didn't reflect well that, I mean, look at New Japan in 84, especially. Like, what's going on? That basically the entire native roster leaves for two different companies.
That's true.
Well, we don't know what's going on.
Because I was thinking about the other day about when Choshu went to All Japan, and for some reason I just overlooked. I've forgotten all about when the Bulldogs first went there. You know, I always think about the Bulldogs when they returned after WWF, but I just overlooked that first run there.
Yeah, although technically they were not part of the Choshu group.
No. I'm just saying, you know, it's the same time period. So I was thinking about the Choshu thing. I forgot all about the Bulldogs jumping also. Really just the craziest time, an exciting time. It is exciting when all of a sudden top guys are just showing up back and forth on different promotions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty cool. But all right, Bix, well, there's our final what if this week. Any final words you have for the listeners? There it is. What if with myself and David Bixenspan? More great scenarios. We'll have another one of these probably pretty soon here on the show. John, what if? It's a segment you got to participate in one of these one time. You'd be great in it. What if Ric Flair really had slept with 10,000 women? That could be the what if next time, I think.
Now, you and your dad were speaking on the show last week, and I think it was you who kind of scoffed at the 10,000 number that Ric Flair put out there on the 30 for 30.
I certainly
I'll
did.
I'll bet yeah. Ric Flair, I'll bet that's conservative.
How?
And I'll tell.
Yeah. I'll what tell you how. This. Yeah, and get your calculator out while you tell me this, because I want an actual equation of how this number could be tabulated.
Okay, here we go. I was at a Resi's convention in New York right before Ric Flair started with the WWF, and I was hanging out with some of the guys at the bar. And Rick shows up, and he looks immaculate in his suit, and you know his hair is perfect and everything. And he's talking to this girl, and the two of them take off together. Rick returns maybe an hour later. His clothes are a little bit less, I don't know, they were a little bit wrinkled. His hair wasn't as perfect. And he approaches another girl, and they're talking, and they depart the bar as well. About an hour later, Rick returns. His hair's a complete mess. His clothes are completely a wreck. Goes up to another girl, talks to her, and they leave. I don't know if it ended there. I had to leave at some point, but I personally saw three in one night.
You don't know, but I mean, this is the 1991 John Arezzi. He may have said, hey, I got the new Nirvana record upstairs. You want to come check out the lead single? I mean, I don't know. I mean, the other thing is just, I mean, I know he used to Stairmaster a lot, but that's a hell of a lot of stamina if you're going to keep up a pace like that to do 10,000 over 70 years. Well, let's be honest. It's probably over 57 years or, you know, maybe a little bit less than that, but I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, I personally saw three in one night. That's 1,000 in a year. That's 10,000 in a decade. I'm not saying that happened every night. But, okay, yeah. I mean, we're going over at least three or four decades when Rick was, you know, kind of doing this. And I think 10,000 is conservative. I mean, I've been around these guys. I see what goes on. You know, there are girls waiting for them.
My dad, you know, uses the Wilt Chamberlain scale for everything. could Wilt Chamberlain have kicked their ass? The answer is always yes. And could he have slept with more women than Wilt Chamberlain? The answer is always no. So that's my dad's Wilt Chamberlain thing. But yeah, I scoffed at it just because the other thing is Flair just throws stuff out there without any thought. You know, like, yeah, sure, I slept with 10,000 women at least. Like, I don't think Ric Flair has ever actually sat down and said, all right, let me figure this out.
I got to do that.
Yeah.
I just thought of that. I don't think it's coming out to 10,000.
You never know. If you have a funny way of doing math, you may end up with 10,000. John, moving on from there, let's go to our next
segment. Let me throw this in really quick. RIP David Cassidy, believe it or not, he has an excellent autobiography that I read maybe 20 years ago. And he would talk about how girls would approach him. And he would say, look, I'm giving you 10 minutes of my time. What do you want to do in those 10 minutes? And they'd be like, well, let's do it. And if you're a girl and you like Ric Flair, you know, he could just, hey, here's what we're doing. I mean, like I said, that's kind of what I saw.
There you hear it. The voyeuristic visions of John McAdam here on the show this week.
I need a podcast, Voyeuristic Visions.
Well, let me know if you ever want to do a podcast. Just give me a heads up. But John, with that, it's time for us to go to a segment that has become quite popular with the listeners of the Super Podcast, Front Row Section D with John Hitchcock. But before we get there, I want to tell everyone a little bit about our friends, the wrestling fans over at Ramsore Records. And of course, you can go to their website, ramsorerecords.kungfustore.com, R-A-M-S-E-U-R, ramsorerecords.kungfustore.com. Use the promo code 605 at checkout and save 20% on all purchases. I want to specifically talk about something you can get from ramsorerecords.kungfustore.com. If you're a longtime listener, you may remember hearing about this a long while back. Josh White, Josh at Midnight, a landmark album that was originally on Elektra Records. It actually really helped put Elektra on the map. Jack Holtzman from Elektra handled this project personally, and he was involved in this reissue that Dolph did on vinyl. So for all you record collectors out there, this is something you need. It is an amazing record. Josh was the first African-American artist to have a million-selling hit. So he's a legendary artist, and this is a landmark album, and I actually have it in my collection. It's something I very much enjoy. On 180-gram vinyl, it's Josh White, Josh at Midnight. Once again, you can get that at ramsorerecords.kungfustore.com, R-A-M-S-E-U-R, ramsorerecords.kungfustore.com. Ramsor Records, the Mid-Atlantic Wrestling of the music industry. And let's stay on the topic of Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, and let's go to John Hitchcock, Front Row Section D. John, this time we're going to talk about the infamous Night of the Squeegee, and we'll talk a little bit more about this on the other side. Let's go to John Hitchcock right now. I'm happy to welcome back to the Super Podcast John Hitchcock, author of Front Row Section D, also the man who sat in Front Row Section D. John, welcome back to the show.
Let's rock and roll. It's great to be back.
You know, you teased something last time. You said squeegee, and I said, let's talk about the squeegee. You said, oh, no, not today. But let's do it today.
Yeah.
Beyond what happened with you, and we'll talk about that in Greensboro that night, the squeegee story in and of itself, the actual squeegee, is pretty legendary. And at the time, it was something that every newsletter was buzzing about.
Yeah, the famous story of all the WCW guys are in the bar,
And then Sid Vicious makes this comment that they should get rid of all the little guys because, you know, the big guys are drawing the money and they should fire the little guys and bring the little big guys in here. And the big guys, you know, and of course, who's Sid, the biggest guy as far as size and lack of talent. And he was running his mouth, and Pillman and I think it was Mike Graham told him to hit the bricks or something, you know, kind of chased him out of the bar. And then he said he couldn't fight him because he had surgery on his shoulder and he had a Band-Aid on his shoulder, some kind of bullshit. And so he ran out to his car and he came back in the bar and threatened him with a squeegee. You know, I'll take you on now. I got a squeegee. And legend has it that Pillman and Mike Graham fought each other for the right to take the squeegee away and beat Sid up and chase him off because they thought, you know, and that's the story that I heard. Now, as soon as we heard that, I said, I got to do something with this because it's just too good a story. And sadly, Sid was not in Greensboro for the show, but Mike Graham was and Pillman was. And, you know, it was going to be a pretty good show. And this was, weirdly, I can remember this, 1991. So anyway, I was at my place of business at Parts Unknown, and I started making these cardboard squeegees. And I drew them up to look like a squeegee out of a poster board. And on the back, I put copyright front row section D on the back as a joke. And I made about 15 or 20 of these things. And we had a big crowd going, as usual, on the front row. So we went to the show, and everybody that went with me said, you know, Hitch, you're full of shit. This is the dumbest thing you've ever done. And I said, well, what the hell? You know, why not give it a shot? I mean, we had signs for people and stuff. But anyway, one of the early matches, Mike Graham was in a singles match. And we pulled the squeegee out and started, you know, like, hey, Graham, you know, that kind of stuff. And he was the old salty pro, right? He blew us off and didn't pay any damn attention. So the next match was like Pillman and Zinc versus I don't know who. And we just went crazy. We pulled out I painted out the squeegees, and we started doing, you know, like, the Florida State, the Atlanta Braves chop, you know, going nah,
the tomahawk chop.
We did the tomahawk chop with a squeegee, and we're all doing the squeegee, nah. And I think it was Casey O'Connor yelled out at Pillman and said, hey, Pillman, what would you do if Sid was here? And he said, I'd kick his chicken ass. He's a big pussy. And he starts yelling, and we're all laughing. We're like, I can't believe this guy's going off. So they have a match, and it's a good match. You know, those guys, you know, guys, very talented guys. And then when the match is over, Pillman runs down to me, and he goes, hey, Greensboro, give me one of those squeegees. And I went, sure, Brian, here you go. So I hand it to him. And he grabs the squeegee, and I swear to God, he walks around the ring going, bah, 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 and he walks around the ring with it. And we're like, oh, man, this is great. These guys are playing off of this shit, right? Well, a little later, the next match was the incredible, incredible match. Lex Luger with Gary Hart versus Bill Kazmaier. Now, you couldn't ask for a more stellar cast, and we knew this match was going to suck shit through a straw. You know what I mean? We knew this had disaster written on it.
Kazmaier and 91 Luger together, that's not a good combination.
Oh God, it was. And what was funny is we started heckling Kazmaier. I think Bruce was there, and Big Eddie and Oban, and they kind of heckled Kazmaier about something about, you know, hey, Kazmaier, you know, you're going to have to carry Luger or some kind of shit like that, which is pretty funny. And Kazmaier turns around and just starts cussing us out, calls us motherfuckers. I mean, excuse my language. I mean, he just cussing us like crazy. And I yelled at him. I said, hey, aren't you the baby face in this damn match? Where the hell are you? What's your deal? And he kind of sobered up for a second, but he was angry. He was a real surly guy. And so he gets in the ring with Luger, and it was really kind of an interesting concept match because all Luger's life, he was the guy that did the strongman moves, right? And somebody else had to sell him. Well, in this match, Luger was the seller, which is really kind of funny to think about.
Yeah.
Because Luger was not a seller. I mean, he was not good at that shit. And they would lock up, you know, test of strength, and Kazmaier would move his arm and Luger would fall down. And Luger would run off. They'd run off the ropes, and Luger would run off the ropes going up to get Kazmaier, who had, like, you know, he was like a statue. He couldn't move. And Luger would bounce into him and fall down and bust his ass. And then Luger would get up and come off the ropes and feebly take a clothesline. And the guy would just put his arm, Kazmaier just put his arm out, like, run into this log. You know what I mean? And he'd fall down. And finally, Luger just falls out of the ring, right? And we're sitting there going, oh, my God, this is just terrible. We feel this is really sucks. And Luger starts pacing in front of me. He goes left, the right, back. And then suddenly he turns and he walks up and he walks right up to me and he goes, oh, my God, this match sucks. And I went, yeah. I went, yeah. I said, Kazmaier is just the shits. I mean, he's terrible. there's not a lot you can do with him. And he goes, Jesus Christ. And then he looks down and he looks him right. He's talking to me, just totally break character. And he just goes, you know, I just want you to know that it is nights like this that I just want to walk away from all this shit.
Wow. He said this at ringside to you?
Yeah, yeah. So he just starts talking to me. And I went, well, I tell you what, how about if we start cheering and we'll try to make something out of this because it's, you know, it's going to suck. We're going to cheer you on. We're going to put this thing over. And Luger looks at me and goes, well, do something. He says, damn, this is terrible. Do something. And then then I look over and it's great. Gary Hart, you know, the old pro, right?
Well, not Gary Hart. He was managed by Harley at that time.
No, this was Gary Hart. I know it was Gary Hart because Gary Hart was mad as shit. He was so mad. Harley probably would have been laughing a little bit by that time, but Gary Hart was hot. I don't know why Gary Hart was there. Maybe you're right, probably, but I don't know why he was there, but he was there. Anyway, and so Luger climbs in the ring and we start chanting, it can only get better. It can only get better. You know, we're clapping and we're cheering. It can only get better. And Kazmaier is like, what the hell is going on? And then it was the funniest thing you've ever seen. It's like they lock up into the corner and then Luger winks at me. And I tell everybody, I said, here's the finish. And he trips him. I think it was Gary Hart tripped him. He falls down. Luger puts his feet on the ropes. 1, 2, 3, gets the win, rolls out of the ring and then celebrates with us. Right. He's jumping up and we're all cheering. Yay. You're the greatest, baby. Yay. And you know, I think there was probably 3,500 people there. It was pretty pathetic. And Luger's laughing. He jumps out of the ring. He just leaves. And we're like, boy, that was weird. I mean, that was really weird. So anyway, the last match, cage match, the legendary Mick Foley versus the almost legendary Sting in a cage match.
Or Cactus Jack at that time.
Yeah, he was Cactus Jack then. So Cactus Jack comes walking out, and we're all cheering like crazy for him. We had a big banner that said, Cactus Jack, bang, bang. There's a picture of it in the book. You can see it. And Foley was just, he loved that shit. We ended up giving him that after the match. We gave it to him, and he took it home. Probably wanted to prove to his wife he was, yes, a professional wrestler. Anyway, so Foley comes walking out and we're cheering, you know, we're cheering for Cactus. You know, Cactus, you're the greatest. We're cheering for him. And he comes walking out and he's carrying a towel. And he's carrying this towel like he's got it. He's kind of hiding it. And he carries it and he goes to the ring and he puts it in his turnbuckle. And, you know, the cage is up and everything. And then Sting comes out and Sting stands at the cage and looks at us. And he's kind of half smirking, kind of half laughing. So Foley attacks him and starts whipping his ass. They start fighting outside the ring. You know, they're taking bumps on the tables and stuff. And they're right on us, you know, which was part of the fun. If they were comfortable with you, you know, you'd have these guys that, you know, you really just thought the world of. And they'd be right on top of each other, just chopping the shit out of each other, you know. And you sweat flying, and they're killing each other and everything. And they finally fight their way in the ring. And Sting decides to try to climb out of the ring. So he starts to climb up. He's climbing up the turnbuckle, trying to get out on the other side. And then Foley, you know, grabs the rope and shakes it. And then Sting crotches himself on the top rope and he falls down. And then Foley suddenly then looks, you know, looks at us and he points at us. And then he points at the corner and he walks over to the corner where the tile is. And he gets the tile, he picks it up and then he pulls the tile and he's got a real squeegee. And he holds it up to us like, you know, he's fighting vampires and he's got his cross, right? He holds it up. So we start scrambling, and we grab our cardboard squeegees, and we start doing the chop, and we're all chanting, Sting must die, kill Sting, kill Sting. And we're chopping with these squeegees. And Foley looks at us, and he goes, I'll get him. And we went, great. So he goes over to Sting. He's selling the falling on the ropes and crotch, right? And he goes up to Sting, and Sting's kind of staggering up to his feet, and he taps Sting on the shoulder. And Sting turns around, and he goes, look, and he puts the squeegee in Sting's face. And Sting runs from him. He goes, oh, no, not the squeegee. And he tries to run away from him. And they're playing this thing up. I mean, like great. And they're running away. And Foley's looking at us going, I'm going to get him. And I swear to God, he hits Sting with the squeegee. Sting sells it like a shotgun blast. And he goes falling on the ground. And he gets on his knees. And he does the Ric Flair. He's begging down on his knees going, no, anything but not the squeegee. And he's screaming, no. And Foley looks at us and goes, did I hit him? And we're all got the squeegee going, yeah, kill him. And he hits him with the squeegee. And Sting goes flying all over the place. And then, of course, inevitably what happens is Sting gets in the turnbuckle, and, you know, Foley swings the squeegee, misses, drops the squeegee. Sting picks it up, hits Foley with it, and knocks Foley unconscious and pins him in the middle of the ring from the dreaded squeegee shot. And we're all like, man, this is funny as hell. And so they Sting bails and leaves, and he looks at us, and he's like laughing. He looks at us, and then Foley walks out of the ring, and he grabs the squeegee, breaks it in half, and he throws it to us. Some weasel grabbed the wooden handle, but Bud Grundy, one of the legendary front row guys, he met his bride, Lisa, on the front row in their house right now on the mantelpiece is that broken piece of squeegee.
Wow.
There's not, you know, his high school diploma. No. It's not his college. No. It is a piece of squeegee from that match. It's a holy relic that's placed on his mantelpiece to this day. And then Foley grabs we give him the bang bang banner, and he takes off. And we're sitting there, and we're like, boy, what a abstract, bizarre night. And then Tony Gillum, who's the ring announcer, walks up to us, and he goes, just want to let you know, WCW is taking the show to Winston. This is the last Greensboro show. And we were like, oh my God, it's been coming to Greensboro, you know, in the Coliseum since what, like 65 or 66. I mean, it was the biggest arena. It was the biggest place, but you know, WCW was in the tank right then. They really, you know, with all the talent, they just, you know, they didn't know what the hell they were doing. And so, you know, we bid farewell to the Greensboro Coliseum after all those years. I mean, we were the guys there from like 85 to 91. The only two times I missed a show was when I had kidney failure and was in the hospital. So we didn't miss anything. And it was kind of, it was really bittersweet because we left and we went, we'll never have this again. This is it. This is the end of it. You know, now we did go to Winston and we did get front row and we did raise hell, but there was only like 2,000 seats. It wasn't real hard to raise hell in 2,000. We were used to raising hell in 14,000. So it gives you some idea. But when Foley was here for his comedy show, he asked me, he said, you look familiar. And I said, why don't you tell the story since you're in Greensboro about the night of you and Sting in the squeegee match. And he just fell out laughing. He went, oh my God. He said, you know, I used to tell that story all the time, but you know, I haven't thought about it. But for a year and a half, I had to tell everybody that story because it was so bizarre because Sting never wanted to play. He was always business. But when he saw that squeegee that Pillman brought back, they said, we got to do something. So what they did is they broke into a janitor's closet, found a squeegee and worked it up right there in the back. And he said that was one of the few times Sting ever did anything that was like an ad lib thing just to have fun with the crowd and with us and with everything, you know. When Foley did a signing in my comic book store, Parts Unknown, and I made cardboard squeegees and we sold them. We sold it. He'd sign them and we'd sell them for $10 a piece. It was pretty amazing.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, he was great. You know, it's funny. Foley was there for 2 hours, but he stayed for 4.5 hours because he wanted to look at the comic books because when he was young, he had a subscription to Fantastic Four and the Incredible Hulk, and he wanted to look at the comics. And everybody had already left, and then people were kind of trickling in. And there's Cactus Jack, there's Mankind sitting in the damn store reading comic books. It was cool as shit, you know? So, yeah, it was really a lot of fun. But, you know, I always loved that guy. I always thought he was an incredibly talented guy. But that was a bittersweet, but there was such a weird night. I mean, it was such an odd night, you know?
Did Pillman usually play along with you guys?
No. Not. We used to give Pillman a lot of shit because he was a good guy. You know, we had our prerogatives in order here. We always cheered for the bad guys. And when he tagged with Zinc, we did a sign once that said "Crying Brian and Tom Stink." And man, I thought Pillman was going to try to kill us to tear the sign up. He was hot about it. He really was playing it for all it was worth. That he did not like that, and he was using it to get heat. You know, they all like to do that. But you know, Arn was the king. Arn will always be the king. So we always had to have something for him.
In terms of this being the last show in Greensboro, what was that last year like in general? And I'm sure you've heard the things that so many other people hear. You actually attended the shows. It's not as simple as they took Starcade out of Greensboro. There's a number of things that led to Greensboro's crowds dropping, right?
Well, that's a tough one to say. But, you know, I think the Starcade thing broke a lot of old fans' hearts. And once you break that trust, it's more devastating than you could ever imagine. Because I was one of those kids that grew up and, you know, you'd get up on Thanksgiving and you'd, you know, you'd watch the parade, you'd have your turkey, then you'd watch the Lions lose a football game, and then you take a nap or something, then you get fired up and you go to Greensboro Coliseum that weekend and watch the wrestling. It was like a tradition, almost borderline religious kind of thing, where it was like, this is what everybody did. And they would sell it out. I mean, people would go crazy to go to that because they knew Everybody with a brain knew that the Christmas shows and the Thanksgiving shows, you were going to see something really special because, you know, they geared up for that stuff. And these were all just house shows, you know. And when they took that out, I mean, I went to the Starrcade where they had part of it was in Chicago, and they only had about 7,000 people, maybe 8,000 people there. And everybody felt cheated. I mean, the whole audience was bitter about it because the big matches were in Chicago and the small matches were in Greensboro. And then the one I think before that was the one they had in Atlanta. And then, you know, but the big matches were in Atlanta, and maybe there was one good match in Greensboro. But it was just one of those things that you know, they had the trust of the fans, and it was a tradition. I was talking to a buddy of mine, Rusty Gleason. We went to school, to grade school together, and he said his father was a wrestling fan from the 30s and 40s. I mean, he was into it. And he said every single year he would get two tickets for him. His dad and him would get two tickets forever on Thanksgiving night. Whenever the Thanksgiving show would land, he had two tickets, same place, same time, always. And when they took it out, he never really went back. So there is a lot to that about how the people were looking forward to it. It became ingrained that it was something that you did. And you know, remember too, at that time, we watched the Washington Redskins and the Baltimore Colts on football. And, you know, and of course, college basketball was king with Carolina and State and Duke and Wake. Everybody was into the basketball, and they still are. But there wasn't any professional thing except for that little moment when the Carolina Cougars and the ABA were around. But, you know, that was our thing. That was our big entertainment. And the fact that it was a territory out of Charlotte, we felt like they were our guys, and we cheered for our guys. You know what I mean? And we, you know, like I told you last time, I got to see everything on cable. But the Charlotte stuff was special because it was our guys. And we knew where they were going to be. We knew they lived out of Charlotte. We knew the office in Charlotte. We knew that that was our thing. When that changed, it was drastic. You know, it's funny. I was just thinking, when the last Crockett show was there, Jackie Crockett was doing – It was some kind of pay-per-view, and they had a match with Nelson Royal versus the Avenger or something. It was one of the Thunderfeet guys, maybe Gene Liggins or somebody. And Gene Liggins was a great guy. And we were sitting there on the front row, and we went, "Oh my God, this match sucks." So what I did is I brought, for some reason, I had the Sunday newspaper with me. I think they were giving them away free out front of the Coliseum. And so I grabbed the Sunday paper and I just went, "This match sucks. This match is the worst shit in the world. So everybody want to read the paper because this match sucks." So I handed out, and our whole section, like rows deep, everybody was reading the newspaper during this match. and Jackie Crockett went ballistic and ran over and started screaming at me. And he goes, "You know what the deal is? Damn it, you know what the deal is. This is the warm-up match to kind of get the people interested and get them back in their seats. You're trying to fuck up my show. What the hell?" And then he said, "You know, I helped make stars out of you guys, and I'm never going to shoot your corner. I'm never going to shoot you guys again." And I'm like, "He made us stars? What is that shit?" We're like, "What? Calm down, Jackie. Don't have a aneurysm and kill out on us or something." And he's just screaming. He's screaming at us. And we're like, "Shit, okay." You know, because, I mean, Nelson Royal, I mean, you can't expect anybody to want to see that. I mean, he was a million years old. So anyway, that the first Clash of Champions, I think, was the first show that was the TBS crew taking over.
TBS took over in the fall of 88. That was in the spring of 88.
Well, it was one of the times that it was obvious to me that Crockett people were not in control, because Jackie did not like us after that. Maybe not liked us at all. I don't know. But anyway, it was hysterical, because that first Clash of Champions, we spelled Cornette across the front row. You remember that?
Yeah, of course.
You know, and we all started chanting Cornette rules.
I think they came back from commercial right to the shot of you guys with the sign.
Well, the floor manager, who was a TBS guy, comes running up to Jackie Crockett and goes, "Oh my God, that's great. Get that. Get that. Make sure to get that. Get that." And Jackie Crockett is recording it, and he is cussing us the whole time. "You motherfuckers, I hate your guts." And we're all chanting Cornette rules. But that was priceless, because Jimmy, we never had met Cornette, but we had long admired him, you know, as far as his talent and his wit. And Cornette was, you know, Cornette was in the ring, and they went to a commercial break, and we're all chanting, and Cornette knew we were going to run out of gas, right? I guess our cardio was in question. Anyway, so he looked at us and said, "Hey guys, I love the signs. I'm going to give you a countdown, you know, 5, 4, 3, and I'm going to point to you. And then they're going to go to a commercial. When they come back, I'll give you the countdown, and we're going to get this all in." I said, "Okay, yeah, Jim, anything you want." So that's how that worked, which was hysterical, because that's the first time we'd ever really done anything for Cornette and the Midnight Express. And it got over like crazy. Jesus, that was great.
And what a night to do it. That was an amazing match with Fantastics that night.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and that was something else that was funny about that is we had gone, it had to have been close to the same time period, but we went to Raleigh and saw the match with the Fantastics at midnight. And we knew the finish because they did the exact same match. They didn't change it much. And so we're all sitting there, and we knew kind of what was going to happen is that they were going to, you know, Cornette was going to not get whipped, and he was going, they were going to hit him with a racket, and they were going to whip the Fantastic, you know, Bobby Fulton and Tommy Rogers, and they were going to whip him, and they were going to run away. And so we're sitting there, and sure enough, you know, it happens. Fantastics win. And there's this guy in the crowd who runs down to the front, and he starts yelling at us during the match, and he's totally obsessed, and he's screaming at us. And he's going, hey, man, he said, I can't believe you cheer for those guys. Cornette's going to get his ass whooped right now. And I looked at him, and this was one of the best lines Bruce Mitchell ever had. Bruce looked at him, he goes, I don't see anybody getting whipped yet, old man. Now, that guy never heard old man in his life. And he went, old man, he started yelling at me. And I went, security, I have my tickets. I believe this man is not sitting in our section. Security told the guy to shove off, and he kept running down yelling at us, you know, and we just sit there and go, you know, we're sitting there going, I said, look, man, I'm sitting close. He said, Cornette cheated. He hit him with the racket. And I said, I'm sitting closer than you, dude. I got 20/20 vision. I didn't see it. And I'm sitting closer to you. And he's got glasses. He can see good too. And we all look at each other and go, what are you talking about? Maybe you got a problem. You look kind of old. And he get all mad and shit. So, I mean, we worked this guy like crazy. And then, sure enough, here comes the finish. Bang, bang, bang. And the guy runs down. Cornette's going to get his whipping now. You're going to see your boy get beat. And we said, we'll see. And sure enough, boom, boom, boom. And then we turned around and looked at the guy and said, who's getting whipped now, old man? And I swear to God, his face was as red as a stop sign. He was so fucking hot. And he was so mad. And we're just laughing at him going, who's the man? Who's the champs? Who's got the belts? Who got the whipping? Thank you. Please, next. Move along. Man, that was funny as shit. It was every once in a while you'd do that. You'd hit Raleigh and then Greensboro, and if you were really fired up, you'd go to Charlotte the next night and you take in all three shows and see everything. So it was really cool.
And in terms of Greensboro, that last year, 1991, that was the last show. It's the end of the year. I think it was November. When did you first notice the crowds weren't coming back?
I don't know. It was one of those things that they would do like 10, 11,000 for house shows. But then it would be 9,000. Then it would be 8. And then it would be like 65. It was one of the few times that Flair ever broke character. I think I said that on Jeff's podcast, but yeah. he was in the ring and he just suddenly broke for a second. Like me, he goes, where is everybody? I mean, it was obvious that something was terribly wrong. You know, Jim Herd was a big part of it. But it just seemed like the guys were going through the motions and it wasn't their fault because the storylines were all terrible. I mean, you build a show around RoboCop, you got to be fucking kidding me. You know, I mean, he's not going to make you any money. So it was one of those progressive things where you see each show drop by 800 to 1,000 people. And before you realize that, you know, I had fans call me, say, you going to be there? And I was like, yeah, sure, of course. And he goes, well, if you're going to go, we're going to go. At least you'll stir it up. It'll be fun. We'll see what the hell happens. You know, what the hell. But, it was devastating to watch it go the way it went, but you never thought it was going to end. You just figured that somebody with some brains would take over and be the booker and, you know, and really pop the place back up. But it never really happened until they did the New World Order, and then that shook it up. But they didn't go back to Greensboro for that. They stayed in Winston. So we never thought of it as being depressing because we got to go to wrestling, got to sit on the front row, and we got to have a good time. But it was kind of alarming to see the crowds fall. And there, I don't, you know, it's really tough to, it must have been really tough for those guys. There was one night, the opening match was Cactus Jack versus Bobby Eaton. And the reason why they were the opening match is Jim Cornette was having a birthday party in Charlotte. And they wanted to get through and then go party with Cornette for his birthday party. And so those guys started the show. And we knew that Cornette was going to have a birthday party because Mike Gunter, another super fan and great guy, was going to go to the party, was invited to the party. He was friends with Cornette. And we were not invited, but that's okay too. And we knew what was happening. So we sang happy birthday to Jimmy on the front row during this match. And those guys started laughing. And then it was one of those things that is like, let's make something out of this. And Foley and Bobby Eaton just tried to see who could throw each other through as many empty chairs as they could in the end zone at a time. And they were bowling each other head over heels through these chairs. and taking out two, three rows of chairs because there's nobody there. And they were just doing it. And then Foley would do it, and then Bobby would do it, and then they would do it again. And then finally they finished the match, and they left, and they were all laughing. But it was the weirdest thing because you knew the thing was shaky, but you figure with Turner's money, this thing would probably go on forever. But they started cutting back. So that was kind of sad.
There he is. John Hitchcock with Front Row Section D, become quite a popular segment here on the show. John, you know, you were involved with the newsletters and you were a tape trader. Did you get to know John Hitchcock at all?
I got to know him a little bit, but I actually met him in person at the 1991 Great American Bash. As we all know, Ric Flair had just recently been fired from WCW. So I go up to John to say hi, and he has a giant sign that says, "We want Flair." He's got a giant sign with him, but he's off camera, and I'm right on camera. So after the Lex Luger, Barry Windham main event, I go running up to John. I'm like, "John, I can get that sign on camera." I was right in front of it. So if you go to WWE Network and you watch the very end of the Great American Bash, you will see me holding up a sign that John Hitchcock made that says, you know, "We want Flair." And it was cool because every time I put the sign up, they would do a different camera angle so you couldn't see the sign, but they had a video of the event that was going on. So I would put the sign down, and then as soon as they went back to the main camera angle, I would just put it back up. So I had a good time, thanks to John.
That's pretty funny. What was it like there in that building that night? I mean, it's a pretty legendary show because of it, you know, being a disaster. What was it like in Baltimore that night? It was supposed to be Ric Flair in the main event. Instead, you got Windham against Luger for the title. No Flair.
They announced before the cameras went on that Ric Flair, you know, had been fired, and that the main event was Lex Luger and Barry Windham, and a deafening "We want Flair" chant went up. They did it brilliantly because everyone got it out of their system before the cameras were rolling. Dustin Rhodes was in a six-man tag, and me and my friend just out of nowhere got up and started screaming, "Dustin sucks, Dustin sucks." Everyone around us started to do it as well. I'm not sure if that came out on the WWE Network version of it, but everyone was just pissed off at the product. I think everyone saw through like what was going on with Dustin. Nothing against Dustin, but in 1991, he was way overpushed. But yeah, there was a lot of anger in that building that night. Oh, let me tell you something else cool about that day. We were on the elevator with Harry White. We're going down from the hotel, and we get out, and Harley Race is waiting to get on the elevator. Now, Harley and Harry knew each other, and they're like, "Wow, we bump into each other in Baltimore." So I got to meet Harley Race briefly. Then later, we're going down the elevator. It's me, Wade Keller, and a bunch of people. And who's waiting to get on the elevator? Eric Bischoff. We had no idea he was coming in. And we're all like, "Oh my God, they're hiring him. Yuck." Well, that night was the beginning of Eric Bischoff totally changing wrestling history by getting that job.
Did Wade know Eric from Minnesota?
Yeah, they both, once again, they're in Baltimore. They know each other from Minnesota, and they're each getting on and off this elevator. So they stopped and had a brief conversation, and I got to meet Eric Bischoff very briefly.
With Harry, it's interesting because I've been around Harry when he would talk to wrestlers. I always found it interesting because you get to know Harry as this really funny older guy when you're a fan. But when you watch him talking to wrestlers, there's like a mutual respect there. It was always I always loved watching Harry have conversations with wrestlers that he had obviously met at the Kiel.
And, you know, he was a really smart, funny guy. He was so much fun to be around. I mean, we loved him.
Yeah, I miss Harry. Everyone misses Harry. You always hear that. Everyone misses about him on the show. But with that, let's go from the late Harry White to Book of the Week.
Book of the Week.
And this week, Book of the Week is "How Can You Defend Those People?" by Mickey Sherman. Mickey's going to be our guest here in the next segment. This book is all about Mickey's career, all about the crazy cases he's been involved in. Lots of good stuff. And one of the stories in this book is the story that we're about to tell, Mickey defending the Iron Sheik. So I encourage you, if you enjoy this segment you're about to hear with Mickey Sherman, then get this book, "How Can You Defend Those People?" by Mickey Sherman. Of course, it's available from Amazon. And if you're going to go to Amazon, please use our show link, tinyurl.com/superpod/Amazon. By using that link, you do exactly what you would normally do. You spend the same amount of money you would normally spend at Amazon. It's just that every item you add to your cart after using that link, we get a little bit of love and support for. Amazon goes, "Hey, how did they get there? It's from the Super Podcast. We love the Super Podcast. Let's take care of them." So if you enjoy the Super Podcast, hook a brother up. You don't have to do anything. Just use this link, and it supports this show. If you like the show the way it is, not jam-filled with ads, listener supported, then please consider using tinyurl.com/superpod. Amazon. Give it to your wife and your girlfriend, your kids, whoever it may be, and use it for all of your holiday purchases, Hanukkah, Christmas, and Kwanzaa. tinyurl.com/superpod. Amazon. Lots of other shows have links they want you to use. Lots of other shows try to find ways to convince you to support them. At the end of the day, go listen to everyone's show. Put your headphones in your ears and listen to everyone's show and may come to the decision on your own. Which show sounds the best? Which show has the best guests? Which show has the most intelligent wrestling conversation? I think if you think about it for even a second, you will come to the same conclusion that I and so many others have made. When it comes down to it, when it comes down to them or us, fuck those guys. Support the Super Podcast. Support your Super Podcast. John, with that, like I said, we're about to go to a conversation with Mickey Sherman. But before we do, we're going to play a little bit of classic audio here. This is going to be referenced in this conversation. This is the video that Mickey had made with the WWF of the Iron Sheik getting testimonials from various characters in and around the WWF, a tape that they would send to the judge in order to persuade him to let the Sheik go. Let's go to this audio right now.
Judge what?
All right, we are going to do... I need quiet, please. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special presentation, and I need quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special presentation. This is a presentation that is designed and geared to help benefit the Iron Sheik in his cause.
I'm going to give you a cue. Thank you very much. We're here today to talk about the Sheik. Your Honor is well aware that the Sheik has been charged with assault in the third degree in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We've got some people here who know the Sheik, who work with the Sheik, and who think very well of him. Right now we have Freddie Blassie, his well-known manager. Freddie, the Sheik has been charged with a crime. I'd like you to tell Judge Rotman and the prosecutor what your opinion
is. Just a minute, you pencil neck geek. Don't interrupt me. Judge Rotman, let me tell you right now, I've never met a more honorable man in my life than the Iron Sheik. The man's word is better than all the money in a bank. You know what I'm talking about? And listen, Judge, you pencil neck geek, you, I'm telling you the way it is. And Sherman says you're going to be running for office soon. Listen, I'll get out there and I'll vote for you 10, 15 times if necessary. But this is my man right here. And you better do right by him, you pencil neck geek. That's, you know what I'm talking about? Old Judgy, oh boy. Keep quiet, Sherman.
Thank you very much. Next we have Arnold Skolin.
How are you?
Arnold, nice to see you.
Nice seeing you. I've wrestled the Sheik many a time, and he was a tough man in that ring. But outside that ring, he's a real gentleman.
A decent man?
He's a decent man.
And you don't think he's capable of committing the crimes that he's been accused of?
No, I don't believe it at all. I'm if he was in a ring wrestling him, I could see him do something like that. But not outside that ring. He's a real gentleman outside
Arnold,
that ring.
Thank you very much for coming. I think next we have Bobby the Brain Heenan.
That's right. I've been acquainted with the Iron Sheik here, Cosgrove Vasari, for almost 15 years of a professional wrestling career. When he taught the Olympic team at the University of Minnesota. When he came over from Iran, when he started in professional wrestling, I know him from the beginning. No man has dedicated himself harder than this man in the sport of wrestling, Greco-Roman, freestyle, professional wrestling. The man is a dedicated athlete. He travels day and night all over the United States, all over the world. He's one of the busiest wrestlers in the world, and he has a language problem. He doesn't always understand things, and I think that he deserves a break. And everybody makes mistakes every now and then, and I just think he was a victim of circumstances.
You think maybe the language problem had something to do with the incident?
Well, of course
it was
a
misunderstanding?
That's what I would say. I know he has a lot of trouble with referees, has a lot of trouble with opponents. He has no trouble with judges. He has no trouble with Bobby the Brain Heenan. So try to be a fair guy. Give him a break. I think it's the fair thing to do. And if you do, Judge, I'll make sure 10, 15, 20 people vote for you. How about that, pal?
Thank you very much. And, of course, Lou Albano, what else can you say?
Judge! The only thing I can say is I know Cosgrove over Sheik for some 15 years.
He has set a fine example. As rough and as tough as he is, he has gone with the youth. He showed people how to wrestle. He's a silver medalist in the Olympics. He's got it all together. In my book, and in your book, and the book of the people, this is a man that is a family man, has three children, has integrity, has decency, has honor. Yes, he's rough. Yes, he's tough. Yes, he's wild at times, but misunderstood. He does not speak the language. He does not understand the language. He can be misinterpreted. He can mispermeated, misdebilated, missubulated. But the man is one of a kind, often imitated, but never judged. Just a minute. I don't care about your election. I don't care what you're running for, because you ain't bothering me. But I'm going to tell you, with all honesty and decency and integrity, this man is one of a kind. I respect him as a human being. He wrestles rough. He wrestles tough. He's unbelievable. Never matched. But he's a good, compassionate human being, a family man. Listen to me. Give him a break. He's good. He's honest. He's decent.
But
God bless you. Thank you. But what?
But do you feel strongly about it?
Do I feel strong? Yes, very strongly, because I know he's misunderstood, misinterpreted, and he's a good man. If he weren't good, I wouldn't stand after him.
Thank you very much.
And I'm the captain. You got it?
Thank you, Lou. And lastly, of course, Mean Gene.
I thank you very much, Mr. Sherman. If I may, I would like to just expostulate momentarily on the virtues of this very fine gentleman to your immediate left, Khosrow Vasari. He's known as Sheikh Lahani, or the Iron Sheik in his country. In 1968 in Mexico City, I happened to be covering the games for NBC television, and it was at that time that I met this tremendous gentleman, of course, representing his country at that time. Later, as a matter of fact, I happen to be the best man in his wedding. He has a lovely family. He's married to a very attractive Scandinavian girl from up in Minnesota. Judge, this guy is first class all the way. Granted, he does have problems from time to time with the language, but certainly you can understand that. And Judge Rotman, I've always been a big proponent of yours in all of the things that you've been doing in this part of the country, and hopefully you'll take this man into consideration when you have to put the gavel down and close up shop. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's I just I'd like to say this. Hold it. I've got a collect telephone call I've got to accept.
That's the wrestling community. Of course, in the world of entertainment, showbiz, Grammys, everything, Cindy Lauper.
Hello, Judge. I just wanted to tell you, I wanted to talk to you. You've seen all the wrestlers here. I know the Sheik. The Sheik was in a video with me, and I had the opportunity to work very closely with this man, and I believe in my heart that he is a good man. And he is a good man because he believes in things, in good things. And sometimes image can, and I know about that, can throw people. And sometimes people attack people because of an image. I believe very strongly that the Sheik did not attack these people. I believe he was attacked. And this is a common case. And this is something that he deals with every day in his life. I do not believe that the Sheik is capable of doing such a, I guess, a dastardly deed. Is a dastardly deed? How do you say
that's
that?
Dastardly.
Dastardly. I'm sorry. But
one dastard's enough.
Yeah. If you would please take into consideration here that this is a good man, he's a family man, and he's a very hard worker. And sometimes people can be real dumb and do some dumb things to other people. I think that the Sheik was a victim. In fact, I know the Sheik was a victim. A lot of people are in the entertainment field. So if you please take that into consideration, I believe in this guy. And good luck in your election.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you very much. And that's it, Judge Rotman. You've heard everything about the Sheik. I'm not going to have him say anything. You'll see him in court. And we truly appreciate your time and consideration. Thank you.
Rappo.
There you heard it. The actual audio of Mickey and the Iron Sheik talking to many of the wrestling personalities working for the WWF at that time in 1985. Well, from there, let's now go to this conversation with the man himself, defense attorney Mickey Sherman. I am very happy to welcome to the Super Podcast today the famed defense attorney, Mickey Sherman. Mickey, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, obviously, we're going to talk about one of your famous cases. You know, you have a great book I encourage our listeners to check out. How can you defend those people? And we're going to speak about one of those people here today on the show. But
right. For
the listeners who don't know too much about your legal background, can you give a little bit of your background up until this point in 1985 that we're going to talk about?
Okay. We graduated college in 1971, University of Connecticut, then went to University of Connecticut Law School, actually from 68 to 71. undergrad was 64 to 68. Then I didn't have a job getting out of law school. So I went to Europe and just kind of took a long vacation.
That's the way to do it.
So I finally got a job at the local courthouse as a clerk for like $50 a day. Did that for like 3 or 4 months, and then I got a job as a public defender in the Stamford, Connecticut courthouse. And I did that for like 4 years, and then I got bored. Plus, at that point, I'm married with two little kids. And I think I'm making $12,000 a year. And so the only way I was ever going to make any real money is by going out in private practice and working hard, getting established as a good lawyer and making money. Or I could go on some TV game shows and try and make the money there. So I chose the game. So I did it. That's exactly what I did. I went on 3 game shows. Jackpot, Joker's Wild, and the Pyramid. I made $17,000 in cash. Trip to Hawaii for the family for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Luggage, cleaning fluids, a California Cooperage hot tub, all kinds of stuff. But it still wasn't enough to buy a house. Right. So I went, I opened up a practice, and from 76 to today, I've been practicing criminal defense law.
Were you ever a wrestling fan?
Yeah, when my kids were little at that time, the World Wrestling Federation was based here in Stamford, Connecticut, which is one town over the Greenwich. And we'd see the McMahons around and some of the wrestlers around. And again, my kids were young at that point, so we went to a few matches. Plus, I knew some people who were wrestlers. And I wasn't like a crazy fan, but we enjoyed it.
Well, you said that you had run into the McMahons here and there or seen them and the wrestlers around in Connecticut. At this point in time that we're talking about, 85, Vince McMahon lived in Greenwich. He still does. Hulk Hogan lived in Greenwich. Various wrestlers lived in the Northeast just because it was a good center base if you're going to be traveling around the country. Did you, you know, before you even defended the Iron Sheik, did you get to know anyone? Actually, you know, did Vince know you from around town?
Vince knew me from around town. And more importantly, his wife, Linda, knew me more. I think she paid attention to local politics and local criminal stuff. And Hulk Hogan, oddly enough, lived right behind me in a large wooded area. So if you could go through the woods, you could see his house. But they were very much around town, the McMahons, and they still are. Linda has run for United States Senate and I think Congress at one point. And she had a very stiff competition, but she's an extraordinarily capable person, as is Vince. And Vince is, was known for letting Linda kind of run the show to a great extent. So they obviously made a great team. And they employed a lot of people around here. You would see wrestlers back and forth living in this area.
When Hulk Hogan lived behind you past the wooded area, was that when he was still living next door to Vince McMahon?
I don't remember if he was living right there. I don't remember where Vince was living. I don't think so. Hulk Hogan lived right near me, as did Cindy Lauper. And Cindy was going through she was going through that whole wrestling shtick.
Well, let's get to what we're going to talk about today. So this is now 1985. Wrestling is booming. It's a big thing, and it's booming out of the Northeast. Vince McMahon's gone national, but those Northeast towns, it's still just so big, and it's everywhere, and it's on MTV. And during this time, the Iron Sheik, Khosrow Vaziri, was driving on the Connecticut Turnpike, and the alleged story was that he beat up a 17-year-old gas station attendant on the Connecticut Turnpike. Is that what you
remember? He didn't beat him up. He stopped to get gas. It was late at night, and he stopped on the three-way to get gas. Some kid comes out to pump the gas, looks at the Sheik, and says, "You're the Sheik." And the Sheik says, "Yes." Says, "Well, I don't pump gas with commie Iranian mother effers." and he goes back inside. So the Sheik starts pumping the gas himself. The kid comes out to get the money from him. And the kid makes another nasty comment, and the Sheik spits on him, throws the money on his chest, and then pushes him over. Nobody got hurt. It was just a matter of insult words and a tiny bit of physical stuff. And meanwhile, the kid goes back into the gas station and calls the state police, tells them the story. So the police set up like kind of a roadblock a few miles down the road, because they know that he'll be coming down that way. They stop him, and the Sheik couldn't have been nicer to these cops. to the state troopers. He explained what happened, which is exactly what I explained to you, which, oddly enough, coincides with what the kid said. He didn't get, he may have gotten a bloody lip, but I don't think so. There was no injury, and the cops couldn't have been more forgiving of him. When I wrote the police report, it was very funny. Usually the police write, this person said this, this person said this, this person said this, and therefore we were arrested, blah, blah, blah. The cops spent 20 minutes writing a report saying how clearly this whole thing was the cause of the negligence and bad doings of the kid at the gas tank, and saying no way did the sheep cause this problem. They were just totally enraptured by him. So we're going to court, and most states have a kind of a first offender pretrial diversion program, where if you haven't been in trouble before, you'll be on like probation or supervision or something of that nature, where if you don't get involved in another crime over like 6 months to a year, the case gets thrown out. So that's what they expected me to do. And that's what I was going to do. But then when I realized I could have a little more fun by doing this, I went to Linda and I said, Linda, do you want me to get these charges thrown out, right? Yes. Do you care how I do it? She goes, no, do whatever you think you need to do. So I'm talking about having some fun with this thing. And there may be a little publicity attached to it. She says, Mickey, I trust you. Whatever you're going to do, take care of it. Which really speaks a lot, because people think that the McMahons are tough, non-forgiving people. But my experience has been everything but that. They're nice, considerate, very smart people. So the way you do it is you get letters from people saying what a good guy the Sheik is. And he took care of my kids when this happened. He saved me from blah, blah, blah. You just put together up to a dozen letters that you give to the court when you're asking for this diversion program. Before I did that, I went to the lawyer who was representing the kid, which tells you something right there. Why does the kid need a lawyer? And I said, you know, if you want, we'll pay for the damages, because I think he had like $100 worth of damages, injuries at the hospital emergency room, which he went to. We'll pay for the damages. The Sheik is going to be playing at the Hartford Civic Center in a couple of weeks. I'll have a limo pick you and your friends or your wife up and bring you to the Sheik match. You'll have backstage all access, laminate passes. You'll be a guest of the Sheik, and that's that. They wouldn't hear of it. They just didn't want to do it. I said, fine, we'll go to court. This will be granted. They'll pay you nothing. You'll have no fun at all. And you're being a schmuck about it. And that's exactly what happened. But instead of getting letters, as I was starting to put the case together, I realized this could be a lot more fun. So I went down, I told Linda what I wanted to do. I said, just give me about a half dozen wrestlers and a soundstage where Mean Gene does his thing. And I showed up there at like 2 o'clock, and I told these guys what I wanted them to do, as well as Cyndi Lauper, because the Sheik had been in the Cyndi Lauper videos. And I knew her, and she agreed to participate in any way I asked. So you've seen the video.
Of course.
I'm standing there with the Sheik, who doesn't say anything, and the wrestlers come on one by one and say the most vile things about the judge and everybody else. It's hysterical. Lou Albano says, spits on him. Bobby the Brain Heenan says he'll vote for him more than once. Arnold Skolin was there. Trying to think who else is. You've probably seen him more than I have.
The people who appear in that video are Fred Blassie, Arnold Skolin, Bobby Heenan, Lou Albano, Mean Gene Okerlund, and Cyndi Lauper.
Right. So they were all there. How long do you think it took me to prepare all these people to do that show?
Ooh, geez, I don't know. The actual video, I think, is just around 10 minutes. How long did it take you to wrangle up all these wrestlers?
And to prepare them, to prepare them into what I needed to say or not say.
A half hour.
4 minutes.
Okay.
I swear to God, Brian, 4 minutes. I got them on the soundstage. I said, listen, you guys, the Sheik's got busted for punching a guy in the face. He's a good guy. Even if he did do it, I just need you to just say whatever you want to say about the Sheik, no matter what. And don't worry about insulting anybody. Don't worry about this, that. Just be yourselves. Do your shtick. So I was in and out of there like 45 minutes. And as you saw, it came out great. I brought it to court, and I had a TV with me, and I played it for the judge. And his reaction was he needed specifically 11 copies of that tape so he could show all his relatives. The lawyer who represented the victim was all pissed off because the judge didn't even order restitution. But McMahons were happy because the case went away. What was strange is that there was a million people at the courthouse. The word got out in the wrestling community that the Sheik was going to be on the courthouse. And I don't think I truly recognized the following he had. But he was terrific. He was easy to deal with. And he was a lot of fun. I then used that tape around the country in a lecture that I used to give to criminal law organizations called Innovative Practice of Law, like how to enjoy yourself while you're practicing law, but also never hesitate to do something unusual if you get to the place that you need to be. I think it was a few months later. I put this in the book. A few months later, the Sheik was riding to the Meadowlands. That's a venue in Jersey. And he was riding with Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Oh, yeah. This is the famous 1987 incident.
Right. It was a couple of years then. And they were going to the Meadowlands. And they got stopped, I think, for speeding. And in the car was a small amount of cocaine or marijuana. I don't remember that. You probably...
It was both.
I've seen that. It was both.
It was both.
Well, for that case, I needed special goods. And that was, I made sure that I had with me about 100 8x10 glossies of both the Sheik and Hacksaw Jim Duggan, which I had them sign. And the case went away. But the funniest part is that case brought more controversy than anything else in the world. And why do you think?
Well, it was because Hacksaw Jim Duggan and the Iron Sheik were feuding at the time. It was the American
exactly.
hero and the Iranian exactly. you know, enemy. Yeah.
Exactly. I didn't know this because I was way past the point of watching this stuff. But so many people came to the court and were screaming, "What were you doing with Duggan? Was this a fix?" It was so funny that one guy was a good guy, one guy was a bad guy. And there was like editorials in papers, both in Florida, in Jersey, and here. It was absolutely hysterical. That was the shocker.
I hadn't realized that you represented the Iron Sheik in the 87 incident as well. Who's making the call? Who says, it's the Sheik in trouble again, let's get Mickey? Who is the person who actually calls you?
The McMahons, Linda, or Vince.
And that was in New Jersey, so that was also a little bit outside of your comfort area, because in Connecticut, you obviously knew the judges, you knew the prosecutors. Were there any complications because you were going to New Jersey for this?
Only if that I may have not as many 8x10s as I should have.
How many did you go through? How many 8x10s?
Like about 50. And then there was an enormous picture. I don't think it's in the book, of me walking down the street. I look like a gnat next to the Sheik. And there's a whole story on it, which is really funny. And it also plays upon the fact that they're supposed to be enemies. But again, I've had so many lawyers come up to me, those who read my book and those who heard my lecture, just saying that they really enjoyed the lecture because they never thought of any unconventional things such as this. A lot of lawyers wondered why I didn't get arrested, that it was contemptuous. But I knew the judge in Connecticut. Not that he would do anything inappropriate, but I just knew that he would so appreciate the comic value of it that it would cover me. The guy in Jersey, I didn't know, except when I called to make arrangements to go down there and ask for a special proceeding known as Pro Hac Vici, which means you can appear in another state. The prosecutor was very, very receptive, and I just felt that it would be okay. And that's my Sheik story.
Well, when you do something so unconventional, like creating this video where the different personalities are, as they would say it in wrestling, cutting promos on the judge and about the Iron Sheik's character, do you have any fear of it backfiring? Do you have any thoughts of what if this doesn't go the way I expect it to? Especially when you have someone like Lou Albano out there who was a little bit wilder than the rest.
The answer is no. I've done things like this many times before. I think I put it in the book, though. There was a dog that had bitten somebody, and court was being asked to order that the dog be destroyed. And there's two kinds of cases you don't want to have criminal law to: neighbor cases and dog cases. Anything else is easy. Murders, rapes, robberies, not a problem. But you go to court where they're asking that the dog be put away, or that the neighbors are fighting over 2 inches of land. It's crazy. And the lawyer who was representing the owner of the dog that was being ordered destroyed, I asked him where the case is being heard. He took all the English courtrooms. So I snuck in the courtroom with a fake drug, like a doll, with in its mouth said "Free Bandit." That was the name of the drug that was to be put away. And when the judge was not on the bench, I snuck it there and put it right in front of the bench. So when all the press came in to see the case go on, all they saw was "Free Bandit." And that was a little tricky to whether or not the judge would get the joke, but he did.
A few other questions about the Iron Sheik incident. One is the soundstage you said you went to where they filmed all the interviews. Do you remember where that was?
Yeah, same right where they are, where it shows, on the border of Stanford and Greenwich. Enormous building.
So it wasn't an actual arena, is my question. It was the studio.
No, that's correct.
And then in the 1985 incident with the gas station attendant, was the Sheik riding alone?
Yes.
He was riding alone.
He was alone. And it was really sad because sometime after that, he was coming back from a match again alone, and his car wouldn't start. And some kids who lived up in upstate Connecticut saw him at a gas station, saw him having trouble, and they latched onto him. And from that moment on, whenever he had a match in Connecticut, these guys were there to kind of act as a security guard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really nice.
Yeah, it's handy.
He had a very pretty wife. He lived in, I think, I want to say Fayetteville, Georgia. He was at one point a bodyguard to the Shah of Iran, and he was on the wrestling team where he won a silver medal in the Olympics, I believe.
You talked about the gas station attendant's attorney. Was this a civil case, or was there a criminal element to it as well?
Well, they threatened to sue. But he had no damages. So it was just a criminal case. And I just knew it wasn't going anywhere. The problem I had, though, is about 3 months later, that lawyer who I really kind of dissed and made look and had problems with because of he wouldn't take her deal became a judge.
Oh.
Yeah, that was not good. No. So when did this happen? 85?
85.
I think I've spoken to him twice over since then.
You should get the Iron Sheik to come up and make an appearance and wave to him.
He would have. He would have done anything I asked him to do to make this go away. And also, he had no record.
Obviously, the judge really loved this video. What did the prosecutor say? Was the prosecutor Joe Marcello?
Yes, he loved it.
He loved it. Okay.
He loved it. He was probably the biggest wrestling fan there.
So the judge loves it. You put it together, and the prosecutor loves it. That really must have infuriated the now judge who was defending this kid. Everyone loved it.
And right now, there's what we call assistant state's attorneys and then state's attorneys. There's a state's attorney for each county. The one who's the head state's attorney for Southern Fairfield County is also an enormous wrestling fan. You can't help but love these guys. I mean, it was just amazing to me because I watched them for a little bit after we did our thing. It's amazing that they don't kill each other.
Did you ever defend any other wrestlers?
Yeah, minor guys, satellite guys, who usually some narcotics, no steroids or anything like that. Never had any connection there. But I know a lawyer who, when he passed the bar, rather than open a law office, he tried like hell to become a wrestler. In fact, I know his name. His name was Rob Adonis. He's still a lawyer here in Connecticut, but I loved his fighting name.
And you represented other WWF guys for narcotic situations?
Minor stuff. Minor stuff. And as you saw, everyone took it very seriously. Well, they didn't take it seriously, but they just bought into the whole thing. Except for Cindy, who she was arguing in front of the Supreme Court.
That is noticeable on the video. Yeah.
Yeah. She takes it very seriously. She's very sweet. She's lived here in Stanford probably since 1980. She's just a really, really good person.
There is a noticeable change in tone in the video when you go from Heenan, Albano, and Okerlund to Cyndi Lauper, who is very serious.
Yes.
And just, you know, like you said, it's like she's very, very serious pleading this case before the Supreme Court.
And I wanted to make sure I didn't embarrass her.
So you were kind of like, in a way, I guess, a go-to guy for the World Wrestling Federation when things were really happening and they were in Connecticut and they needed some help. You were the guy they went to.
For this kind of stuff.
For this kind of stuff.
They had white collar, for white collar stuff and civil stuff, they had in-house counsel.
Mickey, you've had a long career. You've written this book that I talked about before, How Can You Defend Those People? You've been on television. People have seen you. But when you look back at your career, What place does this incident, does the Iron Sheik incident and everything unorthodox that you did around this case, where does that rank in your career for things you've done?
As far as importance, zero. As far as fun, 10.
Boom! There you hear it, defense attorney Mickey Sherman, the man who took care of the Iron Sheik. Thank you for appearing on the Super Podcast. A really, really fun segment. A fun guy to talk to. I had a good time talking to him, even off air. Really, really cool guy. But John, with that, episode 81 is wrapping up. Anything you want to say here at the end of the show? How can the listeners stay in touch with you?
Let me see. You can look me up on Facebook. I have a Facebook page, a Pro Wrestling and Whatever, if you'd like to say hello.
And I encourage everyone to check out that group. You know, we have the Mothership group, but Pro Wrestling Whatever is the other group I love checking out. You do a great job with that. And there's a lot of really good conversations in there. But as we wrap things up, you can stay in touch with the show by going to facebook.com/superpodcast. That's where you can find out about show updates. You can vote for the top 10, which will be returning in a few weeks. You can see pictures and videos, Travis Heckle's exclusive artwork, give show feedback, and so much more. If you want to send a message to the show, the best place to do it is facebook.com/superpodcast. If you already like that page and you want to have conversations about all sorts of things with other 605ers, we invite you to join the Mothership Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/superpodtalk. We ask that you are actually a 605er. A lot of people lately have been trying to invite their friends who don't listen to the show. We don't just accept anyone in this group. So if you're a 605er and you want to talk about things about the show or things off topic, modern wrestling, classic wrestling, sports, movies, music, whatever it may be, facebook.com/groups/superpodtalk. You can follow me on Twitter at GreatBrianLast. You can follow the show on Twitter at 605pod, and could follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at superpodcasts. If you're going to use Amazon this holiday season, then use tinyurl.com/superpodamazon. By using that link, you support this show and don't do anything more than you would normally do. Don't spend a penny more than you would normally spend, and you keep this show going the way it is. Once again, tinyurl.com/superpodamazon. If you would like to get a Super Podcast t-shirt, we have them in black, we have them in gray, we have the polo shirts, we have the Yo Mamba 605 shirt, as well as sticker sets, magnet sets, and so much more. More t-shirt designs are on the way in the future. You can go to tinyurl.com/superpodstore, the official online store for the 605 Super Podcast. If you wish to make a donation to the show, if you really like the show, appreciate the way it is, realize, hey, all the other shows I listen to have that Dollar Shave Club crap all over it. This show doesn't. Guess what? We could. We choose not to. And if you appreciate that, if you appreciate the standard and the quality and the integrity of the Super Podcast, consider making a donation to the show. You can make a one-time donation at paypal.me/superpodcast, or you can make an ongoing monthly donation at patreon.com/superpodcast. Lots of other shows have Patreons, and they say you can spend X amount of dollars and receive bonus content. We don't do that. We don't tear off our show. The Super Podcast is free for anyone who wants to hear it. But if you appreciate that, perhaps you're a secret millionaire, then of course you can make a monthly donation at patreon.com/superpodcast. We are on iTunes, and if you subscribe there, we encourage you to please leave a 5-star rating and a positive review. It really helps the show out. You can access the show's RSS feed or download it directly, any episode, the entire run of the Super Podcast, by going to 605pod.com. As mentioned earlier, the Super Podcast is sponsored by Ramsor Records, ramsorrecords.kungfustore.com. Visit that website, enter the promo code 605 at checkout when you're buying Josh White, Josh at Midnight on vinyl, and save 20%. Hey, you can't beat that. ramsorrecords.kungfustore.com. I encourage you to check out the other shows on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Of course, there's Scott Bowden's Kentucky Fried Wrestling. There's Jeff Baldrin's Breaking Kayfabe with Jeff Baldrin. And there's Ron Fuller Studcast. More shows on the way. Those shows all come out once a week. Subscribe on iTunes wherever you find your favorite podcast. If you want to send anything into the show, you can do so by sending it to the 605 Super Podcast, P.O. Box 1242, Morristown, New Jersey, 07962. That's the 605 Super Podcast, P.O. Box 1242, Morristown, New Jersey, 07962. The 605 Super Podcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For John McAdam, I'm the Great Brian Last. Until next time, tally-ho! point and I just lost it. Fuck. What was I going to say? Shit.
Well, maybe this will help refresh your memory. Have you heard the ever heard the Dusty line about Gene, where when Gene Okerlund told him he had a point?
No.
So I think it's a Saturday Night's Main Event or a pay-per-view where he's facing someone, I forget, with a manager, and Gene Okerlund's like, what about manager? And Dusty's like, what about Sapphire? And she's like, you have a point. And a plate to stick it, Gene.
I did not remember that. All right, I remember my point. Here we go.
And a place to stick it, Brian.
Stop it. Now I have to debate. How do I edit this out or do I leave this in? It's time for another of the popular... Ah, fuck.